Russia was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And they'd say, oh, but aren't you so glad that you're in America? I said, well, I know a lot of Russian filmmakers. They have a lot more freedom than I have. All they have to do is be careful about criticizing the government.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Jason Miles, your host for another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you're new to the channel, please like and subscribe. If you're enjoying what you see, make sure to hit that notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live, because we're constantly adding new shows, doing cross streams with other channels. And as you saw with the intro, this is going to be a slight, I want to emphasize the word slight, departure on what we usually do on this channel. This is an episode of Pop Life. We get to talk more pop culture. Last week, lucky enough to have actress from my favorite movie of all time, Diane Franklin from Better Off Dead. And we asked at the end of the show if her and Amanda Wiss would be down to come on to watch Better Off Dead with us for patrons for movie night. So I'm still waiting to hear back and trying to figure out if we can get those dates to line up, because that would be so much fun. Also, before we start, for you audio listeners, Apple's offering a subscription service. So if you enjoy This is Revolution and you would like to hear all the shenanigans that go on in the champagne room, hear some of the calls. We had two great calls. It took up the whole show last night. Then subscribe on Apple. If you would like access to champagne rooms past and present, be part of movie night. Be a member of the live virtual audience for the, Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour. There's only one way to become a patron, for as little as $2 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. Today, I want to talk a little movie review. I do this a lot with Ben Burgess on his channel, where it's usually a lot of us, a lot of shit talking for like an hour and a half. If you've watched any of the movie reviews we do on Ben's channel, it's generally myself and Teray Reed, good friend, and we just kind of roast each other for a good 2.5 hours, kind of sort of talk about a movie, a lot of roasting and shit talk, but it's a lot of fun. This is going to be a little bit more serious because this, for me, movie kind of blew me away. I saw it when I was very young, maybe like 11 or 12. I don't even think I had seen the original Psycho. I think I knew of the original Psycho. It's one of those movies that's just so iconic, you can't not know about it. But I had never really sat down and watched it at that point. But again, I probably saw this at like 11 or 12. And I think it was one of those things where they were showing Psycho 2 and 3 back to back on like Cinemax or Showtime or something like that. Again, as I said before on the show, I spent a lot of time alone, home alone, as my mother worked nights. And I didn't, the impact of those movies didn't really hit me. They were, you know, definitely engaging. Watching them again as an adult, I was really blown away by part two. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. In Hollywood, in the era of the blockbuster in the late 70s and 80s, the motto was more like, if it hits, make more. Star Wars had people going back to see it in theaters dozens of times, so a sequel had to be made, right? People needed more space westerns. Even though evil is defeated and the big bad is destroyed, peace was once again bestowed upon the galaxy, but we needed to sell more toys. Capitalist production made for some horrible sequels and prequels to movies that for the most part had definitive conclusions. When the T-800 was destroyed at the end of Terminator, we never thought we'd get more movies from that franchise. Same could be said of a movie like The Matrix. These weren't necessarily to be continued type films. Back in Hollywood's heyday, filmmaker Alfred Hitchcock hit big with a movie loosely based on the incestuous Oedipal mother-son relationship of serial killer Ed Gein. with his movie Psycho, a thrilling tale that is a noted classic film. Not many people thought a sequel would be any good. Most people I bring this up to have never bothered to watch Psycho 2 or any of the 80s Psycho movies. This 1983 whodunit thriller is the perfect sequel to a classic film, revitalizing his role as Norman Bates as Anthony Perkins, who stars alongside a very young Meg Tilly, who is perfect as the shy yet seductive small town waitress Mary. Tonight, I have my friend and film critic, podcast host, J.G. Michael, and we're going to take a deep dive into the Psycho franchise and discuss why its sequel is an important film, especially today, and why you should watch the third installment in the franchise as well. Please welcome the host of Parallax Views, J.G. Michael.
Hey, hey, hey. By the way, I have to say something here, Jason. See, you mentioned Amanda Wiss, and I can't go without mentioning, today is actually Freddy Krueger Day, and Amanda was in Nightmare on Elm Street. It's literally Freddy Krueger Day. Los Angeles mayor in 1991, Tom Bradley, declared that this was Freddy Krueger Day, September 13th. So,
anything to cash in on a winner.
Right?
The late Tom Bradley wanted a Freddy Krueger Day. Interesting. Interesting. Is this like the day the first movie came out or something?
No, it was when Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare came out. So they did it for the release, but you know, that's why I usually watch Elm Street movies on September 13th because of that. But
okay, well, you guys heard it, September 13th. Let's watch Freddy after we're done with this. Let's all watch Freddy. Let's have watch parties on Amazon. God damn it.
Ben also, I'm jealous you got to speak with Diane Franklin because I loved her in Amityville 2, The Possession, my favorite Amityville movie.
You loved it because she had a nude scene in that movie, didn't you? You loved the nude scene, didn't you? we talk a little bit about that. She's actually very open about talking about all those films, which is really cool. I'm excited. She said she was friends with Amanda Wiss, and we talked about having them both on as Amanda is Beth in Better Off Dead, and of course she's Tina in Nightmare on Elm Street. If I could go down the list of all the people that I never thought I'd speak to in my life doing this show, there's so many people I'm crossing off now. I'm like, I just shoot for the stars. Because there's people I just don't care to talk to that are like famous. But the people that I would like lose my shit over, if we can get Joyce Heiser on here from Just One of the Guys,
right?
I'd lose it. But let's talk a little bit about Anthony Perkins. Also, too, JG, if you have any hookups, if anybody watching has any hookups to Meg Tilly, would love to have Meg Tilly on the show. Psycho 2 and now Agnes of God, two kind of slept on movies starring a very underrated Tilly. The more you know. JG, the term gaslighting, I feel, sometimes is used a bit too much today, but this movie, The Story of Norman, is kind of a textbook definition of the term. We mentioned it a little bit off air. Do you want to give people kind of a rundown on Psycho 2? Because there's Psycho 1 ends, he goes to the asylum, and he kind of has that grin, like, I know I'm crazy, and I don't care. And that's how it ends. And the sequel, it starts off with him getting out of prison. And I think, me personally, this story, especially the time it comes out in the early 80s, when we're kind of knee deep in stories of vengeance in urban areas, right? We love these stories about schools gone awry, firm, hand-fisted principals and teachers have to, you know, restore order.
That's also when you got all the Death Wish sequels coming out.
Oh yeah, we're prime Death Wish 2 and 3, right? So we're in an era, you know, I call it I call the moment we're in right now the Bronson age, right? We're still in the moment of vengeance for vengeance sake. And one of the themes in this movie to me is that Norman can never escape his past. And the only people that actually are allowing him And they're kind of doing it as this good natured gesture to maybe get into the pearly gates or the Christian. I figured it was a Christianly thing to do to give you a job, you know, to welcome you back into society.
Well, I mean, it turns out that the woman who said that to him has her own, you know, craziness going. I mean, that's what's funny about the movie, right? Like, one of the jokes of the movie, if you want to call it a joke, is that Norman is actually the guy who's trying not to be a monster. He is basically rehabilitated at the beginning of the movie. And all the other people around him are the more respectable monsters, and they're slowly driving him insane and back to his old ways. I mean, and it's interesting because you, as the viewer, you're kind of waiting for him to snap. And even though you're rooting for him, you also want to see him snap. You want to see him go back to the old Norman, because that's sort of like what you expect, right? You're expecting it. So you're kind of thinking to yourself, I'm not used to Norman as the good guy, you know? I mean, he is the protagonist of this story rather than the villain.
Which is odd, right? We don't really see him as that. And even in the first movie, we don't really see him as a gaslit victim.
I think you do feel bad for him in a way in the first movie, though. You know?
Do you?
Well, I mean, he's sort of just this, he's crazy and like sort of abused by his mom. You realize he has like these traumas. I mean, I don't think it's really pronounced, but I think Tom Holland, the writer, was playing off that and then decided to take it in a completely different direction than what the original gave us.
The movie starts with Norman, like we said, rehabilitated. You know, he's got a job at a small diner as kind of an assistant cook or a sous, a prep cook, whatever you want to call it, in a really small kind of greasy spoon in a made-up city in California. And he's definitely nervous to get back out into the world. And the moment he gets back out into the world, everybody wants to kind of throw shade at him. Because
everyone wants to tear him down. Yeah.
He's a madman that committed some horrible crimes 22 years ago. Before we even get into the movie, what was fascinating to me about kind of like thinking about this, you know, Hollywood figured that there was a franchise there, right? As a lot of things are getting rebooted. You get Monster Squad comes out, I think, like the next year or maybe even 2 years later, where they're trying to kind of just get the last gasp out of the Universal monsters. I believe there was a Blob reboot.
There was the reboot of the Blob. But what's interesting, the Blob with Kevin Dillon. But I was like blanking on the actor's name. But what's interesting about Psycho 2 is that they didn't really have high hopes for this. Honestly, Universal just thought, let's make some like made for cable movie since cable's getting big now. And we'll hire Richard Franklin to direct it and whatnot. And I'll get into Franklin is later. But there wasn't really any plans to give this a big release. They didn't even know who was going to play Norman Bates at the beginning. One of the people that they had scouted for it was, believe it or not, Christopher Walken. Imagine Christopher Walken as Norman Bates. But Tom Holland, to his credit, wrote a script that was really dramatic bait for Tony Perkins, Anthony Perkins, who was in the original. And then, you know, Anthony looked at the script, was like, this is dramatic pay dirt for me. I'm really interested in it. It takes things into a very different direction for that character. And he's sort of the center of attention. There's a lot for an actor like Perkins to chew on in that screenplay that Holland wrote. So Perkins comes on. And then once it gets announced that he's going to be in Psycho 2, that's when Universal, after all the international attention that announcement got, decides, hey, whoa, we're not just going to make some like little cable movie now. Like, this is going to be a feature length theatrical film.
Mm-hmm. And see, that's what's so interesting about this. Cause this is also before, you know, Nightmare, and this is 83.
Right. Yeah, and I don't think Halloween. They realized that there was that much, you know, that people would be that excited for a Psycho sequel.
But were they? I think I looked in US and Canada, I think it made $34 million on a $5 million budget. So it definitely made its money back. And then some. Enough for them to make, you know, two more films. Perkins gets, he directs, and I think he writes Psycho 3, and we will get in Psycho 3 a little bit later. But the need to make sequels, you know, again, a movie like Halloween, which again has a definitive end.
Right. Halloween it's over. 2 especially.
You know, Halloween 2 is, that's definitely Carpenter saying, like, I really didn't want to make this, and you made me do it. And what else was a sequel? You know, Friday the 13th is out by now, and I believe they already had a sequel by 81.
Yeah, I think the first one came out in 81, and then 82 they come immediately out with Friday the 13th Part 2.
It's like if it's hitting, we got to make a sequel. Jaws.
I mean, at this point, you were even getting sequels to things like The Hills Have Eyes. You know, Wes Craven went back to that and did one in the 80s, The Hills Have Eyes
Part 2. Which was not good.
I mean, it's fun trash, but
I was not a fan.
I can understand.
And when you watch Psycho 2, because you have a movie that's 23 years old that you're making a sequel to, because the first one comes out in 1960. The fact that you can get Anthony Perkins in it is kind of a massive win. And also the mom, Meg Tilly's
Vera
mom.
Vera Miles, right?
Yeah, Vera Miles.
Yeah. Who was in the original as well, yeah.
Is in the original Psycho as well. This is a sequel done right. There's a few times in history where these sequels are done really, really well. What's interesting to me, though, is Norman Bates, and maybe it's because this also is made before we know about how big merchandising is going to be with horror movies, right? We still don't know what the merchandising world is going to look like after Freddy turns into Bugs Bunny after Nightmare 4 and Leatherface 9. But Norman Bates, to me, is a forgotten character in horror lore, mainly because most people just leave him in 1960. And they never go back and revisit these movies, almost as if they're not canon. Granted, there were shows that came out later a few years back. They had the Bates Motel show, which tries to give you kind of the prequel to the Psycho movies. And I never got into that. My daughter actually loved it. I never got into it.
Yeah, but that doesn't even get into like the really crazy spinoffs they tried doing. Like there was, I think in the late 80s or early 90s, they tried doing a show called Bates Motel that was going to be like an anthology show with Bud Cort, you know, that actor from Harold and Maude, inheriting the hotel from Anthony Perkins' character, Norman Bates, and like it would be a different story each week. So, I mean, there's all kinds of like forgotten Psycho stuff out there that was tried.
And Psycho is one of those things that they keep trying to hit.
It's always going to be overshadowed by that, like that original, you know, Hitchcock classic. I mean, hell, they even tried to do that
in the 90s.
I just weird remake with Vince Vaughn that is literally shot for shot the same movie. Only worth watching because Anne Hatch, rest in peace, does something different with the role. But I mean, they've done weird stuff with the IP there.
But this one is really the movie done right. And I think because the story is less a slasher, and it really, this is just my opinion,
it's a mystery. Yeah,
it's first of all, it's a mystery, and I'm sure Tom Holland was like, maybe be like, sure, I said all the tried to do all those deep things with it with the story. Maybe it was just accidental, but I really think it hits on the way in society that we view a mental illness is something that's perpetual, and you never get out of it, and you're stuck for life. And B, the worst thing you've ever done in your life is who you are for the rest of your life. Rehabilitation, you know, outside of the movie, the idea of rehabilitation is a foreign concept to most people. I don't care what your political leanings may be, who you think you are. A lot of people do not believe in rehabilitation. And this movie really shows why. And it's because a lot of us view crimes, especially capital offenses, through the lens of vengeance. We can only get justice if we get vengeance. And vengeance goes so far for these characters, and of course this is a movie, it's fictional, that they commit capital murders themselves. Trying to get this man to do something bad, which he doesn't want to do. They cannot accept the fact that maybe, just maybe, he has rehabilitated himself and does not want to harm anyone. And
I was going to say in that regard, I love the line where the sheriff says, the sheriff in this movie says at one point to one of the other people in the police department, you know, Norman Bates may be crazy, but there's a lot of people in this town giving him a run for his money. I mean, but it plays into what you're saying. Like, there is a sort of respectable craziness that the movie is looking at. Like, I mean, really, the characters in this movie, most of them are more crazy than Norman is, you know, which is why it's one of the reasons it works so well, to be honest.
Norman is a person who's just got out of the facility. He's on shaky ground. He looks like a person that's been in a detox facility. They just got let out into the real world, and they keep walking by bars and liquor stores.
Right? Yeah, his facial expressions in this are so weird, almost like comical in a way. He's like looking up and like just like making these weird facial expressions.
He's chewing it up. He's chewing up the crazy in his latter years. And I felt for maybe because I've worked with so many people in working with homeless people, and then I'm around so many people like that here in a place where so many people get deported for, like, you know, really, really small. For them, people here are deported for some capital offenses. But still, the idea of, like, forgiveness and vengeance and what justice looks like for so many I think that's the way we just view justice in this country, particularly, is like, we need our revenge, we need our pound of flesh, and then we can go on with our lives for some reason. And in Norman Bates's case, this guy that takes these lives, kind of unbeknownst to him, right? Because there's a line in the movie too where the Mary character, who is gaslighting him or trying to gaslight him into committing murders again, and she has to finally admit that she was doing something wrong. She goes, "I didn't know what I was doing." And the cop says the same thing Norman said.
Right. Yeah. That for me is one of the most interesting elements of the movie, is that relationship between Mary and Norman Bates, because she really ends up in a lot of ways doing the same things Norman does. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's weird because they had a very good dynamic on screen. But behind the scenes, apparently there was a lot of tension and, like, Perkins was not a fan of her. My understanding is that it's because she didn't grow up with TV Meg Tilly.
Yeah.
So apparently she didn't know who Perkins was. And she was like, "Why is everyone so excited about him being in this? Like, what about my role?"
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, to be fair, the movie does not work without her, you know, because she goes from, like, being afraid of Norman to caring about him and feeling regretful about what she's doing with her mother, Mrs. Loomis, from the original film, to being afraid of him again. And it's like she's constantly on this emotional roller coaster ride just as much as Norman is throughout the film. And it's her emotions are shifting from scene to scene, and she's able to pull it off quite well.
Well, look, Jane, tell people, can you give the people a brief synopsis on Psycho 2?
I think we went through it. Norman gets out of the institution. His psychiatrist, Dr. Raymond, I believe, played by Robert Loggia, a great character actor, by the way, tries to get him set up. He's working as the assistant to a cook at the nearby kitchen. And everyone around town is kind of put off by him. They're like, "Oh, you know." It's almost like they're looking at him like he's the vampire, and they have to put the wooden, you know, crosses up, right? The crucifixes.
Yeah.
And he ends up hitting up this friendship with Mary, who is working at the kitchen with him. And, you know, it's slowly the big reveal, of course, is that she's working with her mother, Mrs. Loomis, from the original film, to gaslight Norman, to push him over the edge. Meanwhile, though, there's these murders happening, and Mary knows that Norman can't be doing it because, you know, while they were gaslighting him, you know, they'd locked him in the attic. So they're gaslighting him by going around, locking him in places, leaving him, you know, these notes that claim to be from his mother, and dressing up as his mother, Mrs. Bates. But she knows he can't be committing these murders. So you have a bunch of these weird occurrences happening in these murders. And Norman, you know, starts to believe, oh, it must be Mother. Meanwhile, Mary's trying to figure out who is really behind this. And of course, I don't want to give away the final like 5 minutes.
Give it away. It's 40 years old. It's literally 40 years old.
We find out that the woman who got Norman hired at the kitchen, at the restaurant, was his actual mother. And, Mrs. Bates was actually her sister, and Mrs. Bates had adopted Norman and never told Norman about his biological mother. And, you know, after everything that has happened, because basically everyone just dies in this, right? Mm-hmm. Even Meg Tilly dies, you know, as Mary. And she dies believing that Norman has been doing all these murders, even though she should know better. But she says to Norman, oh, I just couldn't tell you, but I wanted to help you. And that's why I killed all these people. And you just see Norman there like, what? Like, that's the last straw. And he finally has it, and he feeds her poison. And then hits her with the shovel, And I love the twist ending, because it's like, after all that, you think, oh, Norman's going to be okay, you know? And then it's like, no. You know, we have to end this on the most dour of dour notes. I mean, it was dour enough having the Meg Tilly character die, because she really does have a rapport, I think, with Norman, and you feel bad for her, and you want her to, in a way, I think you want her to end up with Norman at the end, but... That doesn't happen. And then to add to that, you have Norman, you know, finding out, oh, Mrs. Bates wasn't my mother. This is my biological mother. She just killed a bunch of people. I can't stand this anymore. And he just snaps, finally, in the last, like, 2 minutes of the movie.
Which is, look, he's trying to hold it together throughout the whole movie. Which
And you want him to, too. That's why the film works.
Yeah, the film works well, because you so want him to hold it together in this whole movie. And there's scenes... I watched right before we got on air, and there's a scene where he's in, you know, he has someone that's been, the court had ordered someone to run the hotel for him while he was in the facility. Because remember, he's in a...
Yeah, you're talking about the sleazy Dennis Franz character.
Yeah, Dennis Franz, who plays sleazy better than anyone else in the business. I refuse to believe that man is not a sleazeball in real life. He just does it way too well. But, Norman gets to the hotel and meets the guy that's been running the hotel, and is kind of grossed out by the guy. He's like, you're not a nice dude. You're running a sleazy motel. That's not what this place is, and you're fired. I'm getting rid of you. And the Dennis Franz character is kind of harassing him at work, and definitely harassing Meg Tilly, who in turn is turning up the heat by leaving a note. You know, this is such an old diner. They put the tickets on the little roundabouts, the spinning wheel. And leaves a ticket that says, Mother, Norman killed that whore. And, you know, Anthony Perkins' character is wigging out, because he knows someone has to be messing with him. And the whole movie starts with Robert Loggia, the psychiatrist, going, okay, Norman, you know your mom's dead, right? And Anthony Perkins, yeah, my mom's dead. That's behind me now. And the moment he gets to the free world and starts just trying to live, right? He's getting bombarded with phone calls and crazy messages at his job to saying that his mom is alive. And he's fighting to hold it together. And what's interesting about the Meg Tilly character is when you get the reveal, which is about the second act of the movie.
Yeah, I think I clocked it at around like 50 minutes in.
It's a slow burn to me.
Because it's like an hour and 52 minutes. It's almost 2 hours.
Almost a 2 hour movie. And it flies by. I will say that. That's the 2 hours that really flies by. By the time you find out that Meg Tilly's mom is the one that's been calling Norman and throwing her voice, acting like his mom, and actually setting her own daughter up to possibly get hurt by this man, you have to look at her character as a Norman Bates character herself. Because she admits in probably like the third act, like, look, mom, I went with you to all the rallies. I went with you to all the court appearances. I signed all the petitions. I just don't think dude's a bad guy. Because I think she's starting to see a bit of herself in him. So where he's falling for her, I don't think she sees him that same way. I think she sees him more as a pathetic character that doesn't deserve this treatment. And
yeah, I think she just sees it as morally wrong, really, yeah, what they're doing to him. And it's like, I mean, I think she comes to realize that he, I mean, I think she's the one character in the movie that really comes to believe that he's rehabilitated, you know.
Which is, you know, I think it's a hopeful sign for her that you can get away from this thing, right? Because the whole time, there's even a scene where her mom's like, look, just put the dress on one more time. And then he'll commit a murder. And, you know, we got him. She's like, I can't do it. I just can't do it anymore. And the conversation they have, those are like verbatim conversations that Norman was having in his head. Because until you get all the prequels and the TV shows and all the other stuff, you don't really know what his relationship is really like with his mom. But again, this is all based off Ed Gein, who had a very odd relationship. I believe he had an incestuous relationship with his mother that was forced upon him, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, that's what they're playing off of that as well. With the sequel, that this guy has he's a child. He's a literal man child. And I think Anthony Perkins portrays that very, very well. He's a man child that spent because he's supposed to be what, like 20, 21 or something like that in the first movie?
Yeah, in the first movie, I believe that is the case too.
So he was, and then he goes into a facility for 20 some years. So he's, if you've ever been around people that have been locked up for long periods of time and they got locked up young, that's when you kind of stopped maturing. You may be 50 years old walking around, but there's a lot of life you didn't get a chance to live when you're behind bars like that. So Norman, A, doesn't know how to get along with the opposite sex. And, you know, I think that's why the relationship with them is so cute and why those two play it so well, because there's something about a young Meg Tilly. I think she's a little different now in her older age, but she played shy innocence perfectly. This movie and like Agnes of God.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think the other thing that worked there is, I mean, Tony Perkins himself in some ways as an actor, I think he was drawn to doing this movie probably because he felt like an outsider in some ways. You know, there's the famous talk of whether or not Hitchcock wanted Perkins in the movie because he looked at Perkins and said, oh, this guy is, you know, a gay man. I guess Hitchcock thought he could portray this role because he's sort of an outsider and he's in the closet about stuff. He understands what Norman is going through, that, you know, just the sort of having to hide, you know, personalities and whatnot. I guess that was Hitchcock's thinking. But I think that sense of, you know, Norman really is an outsider. And I think Perkins probably felt the same way in some ways, because, I mean, this is the 80s. We're on the cusp of the AIDS panic and a lot of homophobia. So I think there was something in that character that he probably related to. And I think it works very well.
It's funny that you mentioned the sexuality of Anthony Perkins, because Perkins is in a different kind of Hollywood where you could lose everything from gossip, kind of TMZ level magazine people trying to out you. If you've seen a movie like Hollywood or L.A. Confidential, that's a big theme in L.A. Confidential. Anthony Perkins, if I'm not mistaken, was in a longtime relationship with Tab Hunter. And they would hide their relationship when they would go out because they would both date the same Hollywood starlet. There was a woman they were both friends with, and one magazine would say Anthony Perkins with his girlfriend, I forget her name, and then you see Tab Hunter with his girlfriend, but so they could all be at the same table and go out and kind of live a life and not have people question it too much. So, you know, man, Hitchcock really had some great casting chops in knowing that he could manipulate that. And Norman, you know, Anthony Perkins, to his credit, I don't know if, was he ever out as a gay man?
I actually don't know. I think he may have been later in his life, but I could be wrong about that too.
Yeah. But that, whew, man, damn it, Alfred. Is this Hitchcock's best movie, Psycho?
Are you asking me?
Yep.
I'm weird. I like some of the stuff he made closer to when he was about to pass away. I'm a big fan of Family Plot, and I love The Birds, but yeah, Psycho is right up there.
Hmm. You don't think it's the best?
I mean, it's certainly the most memorable with the shower scene, which of course I like how they replay. I mean, we said that the psychiatrist scene is the start of Psycho 2, but really it starts with a rehash of the famous scene of Marion Crane's death.
Yeah.
In the first movie.
Which was great, right? Just to remind you of what you're watching.
And it's in black and white, and then you go to color. You know, and it's, I mean, the way it was, the transition is very seamless.
Now tell us a little bit about the director and writer of this film.
Okay, so Richard Franklin directed this. He is an Australian filmmaker. He ended up at the University of Southern California, and he was a devotee of Alfred Hitchcock very early on in his life. I think at USC, he arranged a screening of Rope, and then eventually he actually, you know, met Hitchcock. They became friends. I think Franklin was even on the set of, I believe it was Family Plot at one point. So he was a real devotee of Hitchcock. And also, it's interesting, he went to USC with John Carpenter. And you can tell there's a lot of connections between him and Carpenter through his movies. I'll get to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he starts out his film career essentially making like sex comedies and softcore pornos. He made like a movie in 76 called Phantasm with an F, starring Uschi DeGarde, who was known for her bust. And she's in like a bunch of Russ Meyer movies, but that's how he started. You know, and you see this with a lot of these type of filmmakers. Wes Craven started out in adult films too. And then all of a sudden he makes this movie called Patrick, which is a very highly regarded, you know, sort of low budget horror thriller. And after that, he does this great movie called Road Games. It's an Australian classic and basically the ultimate homage outside of De Palma movies to Alfred Hitchcock. And Road Games.
Doesn't Tarantino say that's like his favorite movie of all time?
I don't know, but that wouldn't surprise me given Tarantino's love of, you know, cult films. But yeah, Road Games is a really good movie, actually. It's sort of an Australian outback road movie with a killer on the loose and Stacy Keach trying to track him down. And also it features Jamie Lee Curtis. Jamie Lee Curtis ended up in that movie because of the connection between Franklin and Carpenter. Road Games was well received enough that, you know, Universal was looking for a director for Psycho 2. They say, oh, this guy could do Hitchcock. They get him. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, again, the Carpenter connection comes up a second time because who is the cinematographer that Franklin hires? It's none other than Carpenter's favorite cinematographer, Dean Cundey, who these days a lot of people know him for stuff like Ace Ventura. Mm-hmm. But he started out, Dean Cundey started out as the cinematographer on all of the biggest Carpenter movies that we know and love. So, or the ones we most remember, like Halloween, The Thing, The Fog, etc. So Franklin really got together a lot of great people to make this movie. And, you know, he was familiar with Hitchcock. He was really a devotee of Hitchcock. He knew how to do suspense and he knew how to do sort of a lot of style and a lot of, I mean, I think the cinematography in the film, there's a lot of shots in it that are just, they're not as cookie cutter as a lot of horror movies of the time. You know, at times I almost feel like I'm watching a comic book when I watch Psycho 2 with some scenes, of the shots.
Yeah, there's some scenes that almost remind me of Creepshow, but not as campy. It's
They were able to pull
back the camp just enough.
Right, right. The scene I always think of is the scene where it's switching between the face of Dennis Franz, the sleazy, or Toomey, the sleazy motel manager guy, and Miri McTilly's character, and you have Toomey saying to her, "Oh, how was it? How was it sleeping with, you know, Norman Bates?" And she just, you have that shot of her where it's like the camera's looking up at her, and she just says, "Better than you'll ever know, fat boy." And just the way the shots are framed is very, I mean, it adds like a comic touch to it.
You know, and that's also one of those scenes that kind of lets you into that Mary isn't as innocent as she's playing, because she, you know, why would you antagonize this man? Well, she knows she had an ulterior motive, right? She's trying to get Norman to lose his shit.
Right. But so you have, you have Richard Franklin directing it, capable hands there. And then Richard Franklin sought out someone that could, you know, do this movie justice. And he enlisted Tom Holland to write this movie. And, you know, Holland, I think, is a very underrated person within the halls of, you know, horror movies and genre films. Holland is perhaps, I would say, best known for writing and directing Fright Night, as well as directing and co-writing Child's Play, you know, the Chucky movie. And those are,
he only did the first one, or did he do the first two?
He did the first one.
Okay.
But I mean, he's done tons of other stuff. He did a really good, it was supposed to be a horror comedy, but the studio butchered it and turned it into an erotic thriller. The movie The Temp from 1993 with the amazingly beautiful Laura Flynn Boyle from Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. And they butchered that movie. Then he also did one of the more funny Stephen King adaptations, Thinner, which is the only movie I've ever seen where you have like Roma casting a curse on some white dude, causing him to like get thinner and thinner. So the white dude decides to respond by hiring a like mob assassin to go and kill like these Roma gypsies. I mean, it's a very weird movie, and it's very funny, and it's also, it's not racist. It's actually like a very pro Roma movie ultimately. So I mean, Holland has a few more credits than people realize to his name. I think before Psycho 2, he had written Class of 1984, which is sort of an exploitation cult classic, and also one that I really like called The Beast Within, directed by Felipe Mora, which is, I wouldn't say it's a werewolf movie, but it's a very, it's in that vein of being a werewolf movie. It's sort of like Ginger Snaps, deals with the idea of, you know, hormonal changes in a teenager through the metaphor of, you know, monsters and, you know, stuff of that nature. So he does The Beast Within, which he wrote. You know, he doesn't direct a movie till 1985 with Fright Night, but he writes The Beast Within. I guess Richard Franklin sees it and says, "I want you to write Psycho 2. And he writes Psycho 2 with it in his mind that he's going to get Perkins to do the movie. And, you know, he says, if it hadn't been for Perkins, this movie would have gone nowhere. It would have just been on cable, maybe like HBO or something, and probably would be forgotten.
Oh, yeah. You need Anthony Perkins to come back and play Norman Bates.
Real quick, I was going to say, Tom Holland, I think, really is one of the key factors to this movie working, because, I mean, he turns all the expectations on their heads. So for me, like, a lot of the credit for why this movie works has to go to him. Is he plays off that idea of, like I said, with the original Psycho, you may not feel bad for Norman, but he's like mentally ill, he's traumatized, and you don't know that he's in control. Like he sort of has this altered personality that takes over. Whereas in the sequel, it plays off his vulnerability. You know, he's a very vulnerable person. Even in the original movie, he's just this very weird sort of shy guy, you know. Mm-hmm. Before you know he's committing the murders, you kind of feel bad for him. Whereas in this movie, I think it really plays on that vulnerability. And you eventually start rooting for him, despite him being, you know, the guy who was killing people 22 years ago, you know.
Which is why the third one.
What's that?
Which is why the third one is such a change of pace as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And before we get into the third one, I wanted to say I didn't realize Tom Holland wrote Cloak and Dagger.
Yes, I haven't seen Cloak and Dagger. But.
You're around my age. There's no excuse. Did you grow up in a devout, like, freaking Mormon household or something? Were you, like, hardcore cat? What, were your parents, like, weird hippies who wouldn't let you have television? Like Ben Burgess? Is that how you grew up? You didn't have a television? What happened?
It's weird. I didn't know about that movie until recently. I don't know why.
Did you
It's like a Cold War sort of adventure spy film, right?
Super Cold War. Okay. There was this moment where
it's like people prime thought, 80s Cold War in the same way that like war games.
It is literally war games for kids.
Okay.
When they found out, look, we have multiple demographics and we can make movies for multiple demographics. War games is not hidden with the fucking 6 to 13s. Cloak and Dagger is going to hit with the 6 to 13s. It was like Goonies meets War Games. Because in War Games, right? What is his name? Ferris Bueller. I can't think of his real name. His name's going to be Ferris Bueller for all intents and purposes tonight. He plays a video game and, of course, it's almost sets off World War III, right? In Cloak and Dagger, Henry Thomas's character is enamored by a video game action person who's played by Dabney Coleman, and it's all in his imagination. And he has this, he actually has a video game that inside the video game is this like secret chip that the Russians need. You know, it's one of those kinds of things. And Harry Thomas is coming off E.T. So if you had just watched Goonies or E.T. or any of those movies, this is like perfect for you because you want to see more little kids win. And Dabney Coleman plays a very good kind of dad spy role as the kid's imaginary superhero father-like character. But I didn't realize Tom Holland wrote Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah, I mean, he's all over the place with his career. He even got into acting. He's in, what should we call it? He's one of the main characters in Adam Green's Hatchet 2, if you've ever seen the Hatchet.
I saw the movies. First couple, so I got to rewatch it now. Because Tom Holland's like 80. He's not a young man.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and he's acting in Hatchet 2 is one of the main. I'm like, wait, he's an actor now? What is this?
And Fright Night. We were talking about Fright Night earlier. Fright Night, Lost Boys, Near Dark, the 80s vampire movies, to me are some of the best because they totally changed the genre and get it out of the castle. And I was so mad that the 90s they wanted to put it back in the castle.
You didn't mention my favorite one, the 1986 movie Vamp.
Oh, how can I forget?
With Grace Jones. That is the weirdest. I watched that. I saw it for the first time a few months ago, and I was like, wait, Tarantino stole the vampire bar idea from Dusk Till Dawn for this movie.
To this day?
And no one ever mentions that movie when they talk about the 80s.
I will not watch Vamp alone to this day. That came out in 86. It hit cable probably like the next year. I don't think Vamp did that well at the box office. I don't think people got it. There's some sexy vampire thrillers. There's another Vamp with David Bowie. What's the David Bowie vampire movie?
The Hunger. I love The Hunger.
There's some sexy.
Susan Sarandon, too.
Right? There's some sexy vampire movies that come out in the 80s, but they're definitely out of the castle. And the Christopher Lee Dracula is gone. And Fright Night for me was a great movie. I love Fright Night. Scared the hell out of me as a kid. And I loved everything about Fright Night. Tom Holland didn't have anything to do with the sequel, did he?
No, he didn't work on the sequel.
So. Yeah. I don't think so. But yeah, Vamp.
He also did Fatal Beauty, that murder mystery movie with Whoopi Goldberg. Yeah.
I think I went to the movie theater. I went to the movies.
Or no, he didn't write that. He directed.
I went to the movies with my mom to see anything Whoopi Goldberg was in. Really? Jumpin' Jack Flash, Burglar.
Have you ever seen that one where she teams up with a dinosaur?
Was it in the 90s?
Theodore Rex?
No.
She literally teams up with like a dinosaur humanoid to solve murders.
No.
I can't believe you haven't heard about this piece of crap. It's terrible.
I saw Clara's Heart with frickin' her and Doogie Howser. I think that's enough for me. when it comes for Whoopi Goldberg movies. I don't think Whoopi Goldberg sing Clara's Heart. But let's talk a little bit about Psycho 3, which definitely takes a departure from kind of serious commentary, gaslighting, the way we look at justice and rehabilitation, and just gives us a very fun slashery thriller romp written and directed by Anthony Perkins.
Right. That's what I love about it. It's like, I think it may have been the directorial debut of Anthony Perkins. I guess finally he was like, if I'm going to do these movies, I'm going to direct this. but yeah, I mean, I actually love Psycho 3 just for the opening alone. So you have the universal globe that shows up, and then the screen just goes black. And you just hear a screaming woman saying, "There is no God!" And then it shows this woman like deciding, you know, she's a nun, and she's like going to jump off the church building, the top of the tower at the church, and she jumps off. And that opening for some reason has always stuck with me, especially like the first like 5 seconds of darkness. And just, there is no God. For some reason, that line just like sent chills up my spine. And it's such a weird way to start a Psycho movie. And then you get into her hitchhiking until she eventually comes to the Bates Motel.
What is that scene supposed to mean? Or is it just he wants to start it off with something crazy, you think?
I don't know. I actually had not had a chance to rewatch it. What was your sort of takeaway?
I'm not going to lie. I was doing a few different things as I turned it on, and it was one of those movies that was kind of so interesting that I had to stop, you know, kind of cleaning and typing scripts for the show and just sit down and take it all in, because I was wondering how they were going to continue the story. Because again, Psycho 2 ends with Norman committing a crime, but no one knows that he committed a crime. And Psycho 3 kind of starts with this investigative reporter who wants to just talk to serial killers. She's just got a hard on for serial killers, which I think Psycho 3 comes out with 845.
I want to say 86 or 87 even.
And there is a hard on for serial killers in general. I actually was watching something. I can't remember who the serial killer was about. But there were all these news programs that were coming out around the same time, because there's a lot of things that are hitting all at the same time in the 80s. You got the Satanic Panic, which kind of encompasses child molestation and serial killers to a certain degree, right? And we're
fascinated. Yeah, especially when you have figures like Richard Ramirez running around who is really, you know, you had serial killers like him that were almost like playing up that.
Yeah, image. And you know what it was? I watched a thing on Henry Lee Lucas, and I've seen it before. I honestly was getting ready for this show. I was going to just soak in all my serial killer shit, getting ready for the show. I'll use that as my excuse. And Henry Lee Lucas has a kind of an interesting story. I mean, he's a man that literally killed a couple people, but he didn't kill 100 people, and he just started admitting to murders.
He just claimed he did, and then claimed it was all part of a secret cult, which, again, I think he called it the Hand of Death. Was the cult he claimed existed.
Was just making so much.
No, yeah, he was completely making it up, and it all played into that Satanic Panic, you know?
Which, again, at the time it was hot, and people were using him. If you guys don't know the story of Henry Lee Lucas, it's loosely, there's a movie loosely based on him. Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is based on the stories he told. Because at the time that movie comes out, he's still Henry Lee Lucas, the man that was alleged to have killed over 200 people. And what was going on was these Texas Rangers that had captured him. And I forget what crime they actually got him for. I don't know if it was for the original crime that he actually committed.
Well, they end up starting what's known as the Henry Lee Lucas Task Force. And they go around asking Lucas, did you commit these murders? And they're using him to solve cold cases. And, you know, the way Lucas explains it is, I was willing to lie. They gave me chocolate milkshakes and let me watch TV if I would confess to murders. Oddly enough, there's a movie that came out before Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. It was made around the same time, but released before Henry. So you have to remember, Henry was made in the 80s, but it only really came out
late like 80s.
On video in the 90s.
Because it was this movie is so graphic, too graphic for the theater. Yeah.
Yeah, and it only came out really because people like Roger Ebert were big fans of it. But there's another movie that less people know about called Confessions of a Serial Killer. It's a movie that's made for peanuts, and for some reason, Henry Lee Lucas in it is played by Robert Burns. And Robert Burns, for people that don't know, was the set decorator for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But I'm going on a bit of a tangent. Confessions of a Serial Killer is a really interesting movie from, I think, 86 or 87, that is actually probably a more accurate telling of the Henry Lee Lucas murders than Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. Because they actually show the way that the Texas Rangers give him milkshakes and all that stuff. And by the end of the movie, you can't tell when he's lying and when he's telling the truth. And that movie just came out in an uncut form on different streaming services, including YouTube and iTunes. Oh, wow. And I would suggest people watch it, but I've gone on.
No, I want to check that out, because the Henry Lee Lucas story is so fascinating, because you have this guy that, you know, what JG is saying is that he was solving cold cases, not just in Texas where he got caught. He's solving them throughout the country. So cops from all over the country, if they have a cold case and they want to get it off their books, they're going to Henry and they're asking him leading questions. And sometimes the Texas Rangers are finding out information about the case. So when Henry's questioned, he can give all the right answers. And this man is not an intelligent man whatsoever. I believe he had 3 teeth and they were all rotten. Very, very unintelligent man. He just knew how to get whatever you want to see. He'll be, if you want to see a hillbilly, he'll give you hillbilly. There's a scene in this documentary I'm watching where there's a film crew from Japan working with a journalist that's kind of trying to find out information about him, trying to find out more about these cases. And Henry goes, I haven't got a few people in your country. And they're like, you killed people in Japan? He goes, yep, killed people in Japan. And they're like, well, how did you get to Japan? He goes, I drove there, of course. He was going to tell tales as long as he could tell tales. And he ends up kind of getting himself in trouble towards the end. He does die in prison. He didn't get the death penalty. And that's one of the few.
Yeah, I think it was actually George Bush
commutes the sentence because he says there's so much wrong with this case. And remember, he served time for the person that he killed. He killed his mom, I think. He killed his mom and another young lady. Maybe I don't know if it was a girl he was dating or if it was a little girl. I know she was young. But he did kill 2 people, and he served time for that. And there's all these other murders that he was serving time for. He was so off, he had no idea. He was just adding years to his life. He would fly all over the place testifying, and he killed people that he didn't even know who he
was. Well, both him and, we have to mention, his partner,
sidekick,
Otis Toole.
Who was even worse off than him mentally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can tell, like, they're, I hate to put it this way, but they're like, you look at pictures of them and they're characters out of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre or a Wrong Turn movie.
I believe slack-jawed yokels is kind of the terms you hear people say. They really were that way, and just kind of admit to any and everything you wanted to hear. And
yeah, and when asked why he would do it, why he would make all these false confessions, Henry would just be like, I'm treated like a king here. I get TV and chocolate milkshakes. Yeah. They buy me burgers. Like, but I mean, to him, that's what it was, being treated like a king, because he was from such poverty and such a horrible background.
Horrible poverty.
To him, just having that was good enough.
And you got to keep in mind, too, he was also had a nice familial relationship with, there was a nun there that was very motherly. And these 2 Texas Rangers weren't mean to him. So he had the best relationships of his adult life in prison, confessing the crimes he had never done, than he ever had in the free world. So you can understand, you know, but where, you know, people get pissed off about the Henry story is George Bush Jr. kind of catches a bit of a hellstorm as governor of Texas, because he also does this as he's getting ready to run for president in 2000. Commutes the death sentence. You know, again, Henry Lee Lucas does die in prison. And Bush kind of stood firmly by that decision to not execute a man. He didn't say he was innocent. He never said he was innocent. He said, you know, questionable at best, to what he had confessed to. And there was a bunch of women, mostly surviving family members of people that were murdered. They thought they were murdered by Henry Lee Lucas, and they, you know, fought George Bush tooth and nail for a very long time. Very, very vocal about it. And it wasn't until DNA evidence becomes a little easier to manipulate that they found out, actually, of the 200 people that Lucas claimed to have killed, 20 of the actual killers were actually found through DNA, because certain police departments agreed to open up those cases. And I know some of them were from these people, this small group of women that were very, very vocal about Henry Lee Lucas getting the death penalty. And they found out that, you know, he had never killed their family members. But of the 180 cases, all those police departments are like, we're not reopening shit. It's done. He confessed to it. That's all we need. It's a wrap. So that's the Henry Lee Lucas, you know, in a nutshell story.
But, you know, it's important to talk about, because, like, this is the period where, you know, everyone is gaga for serial killers in pop culture, basically. And that's sort of the background, that's the backdrop of Psycho 3 in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because, you know, Richard Ramirez, I honestly believe in my soul, had they tried him for the child molestation cases, would never have been the quote-unquote heartthrob that he was to many had they known about all of his crimes. And I think because no one finds out about that, I didn't know about that until the documentary came out about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Did you know about that beforehand, JG?
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah, he molested like 30 or 40 kids. And the DA was with one of the girls who was going to testify, because, you know, you have to testify each one has to testify for each count. And she was 6. He didn't kill him. He would take him to his house, do unspeakable things with him, and then drop him off with money to call home. And the little girl was ready to testify, and the arresting detectives and the DA were so kind of moved. They were like, we can't have, you know, 45 little kids on the stand reliving the worst day of their lives. We have him on the murders. We don't need, like, this is literally nothing. You know, when it comes to sentencing and death penalty cases, like, what is this at this point? So they didn't charge him.
Wow.
They decided not to go through with it. It's crazy, right?
I'm trying to take that in.
yeah, it's a crazy tale, because I did not know that was part of one of the things that he did, and it was just so easy to do in the neighborhoods he was in, which were kind of predominant for a while. He was in a lot of Latin neighborhoods, Latin suburbs, that people just kind of weren't really checking for those kids. But also, too, you know, they're talking about an era where a lot of kids are getting kidnapped, whether they're custodial or not, you know, it doesn't really matter. There's a whole craze behind that, which the Satanic Panic plays into.
Not just the Satanic Panic, but even, like, I think in the 80s, there's this weird phenomena that always happens every few decades of phantom clown flaps, is what they're called by, you know, Freudians. But it does happen every few decades where people start having, like, mass hysteria about, like, clowns trying to kidnap children. You saw it a few years ago. I forget with, you know, remember the creepy clown sightings?
Everyone was having, like, 2018? Yes.
Well, that was happening in the 80s, too.
That shit.
I think early 80s. So
John Wayne Gacy destroys clowns for a lot of people.
Right.
You know, he wasn't even a clown that much in his life. And that image for a lot of people is just kind of seared into their memory This is what evil looks like. It's a, you know, crazy man in a clown costume, you know, with a body count in his basement. Which again, Psycho 3, we have Norman Bates. He's back. To most people, he's innocent. He's a victim now, right? Because of the second movie. But he's using the victim card to go on a little bit of a killing spree. You want to tell us a little bit about Psycho 3 there, JG?
Like I said, I haven't had time to rewatch it again, but the thing I remember from it was Jeff Fahey in one of his like weirdest, sleaziest roles. Mm-hmm. You know, and I guess he ends up, I mean, you see him at the beginning, he's driving that girl who had jumped out the church. Mm-hmm. He's like picking her up. She's a hitchhiker now. And he ends up at the motel being like a manager, I believe.
Yeah.
But what I remember very vividly is just him trying to like, you know, boss Norman Bates around. And then there's the famous scene, which is like oddly psychedelic. Everything is like covered in like red lighting and he's just strumming a guitar and he has Norman Bates's mom sitting there and he's singing to Norman. He's like, I'll reveal everything. And it's one of the moments in the film where I think you go back to almost feeling bad for Norman for a second.
Well, he's kind of constantly surrounded by horrible people, right?
Right, right.
You know, back to the whole, this guy has never been allowed to grow up. You know, he's forever a child. The second movie isolates him even more, right? Because the one person that he kind of felt a kinship with, because he can see her dealing with the same kind of mom drama that he has, which is Meg Tilly's Mary character, who in a deleted scene survives. Did you know that she survives?
No, I didn't realize that.
The deleted scene, she survives, but she goes into a mental hospital. Dun dun dun. That they just didn't air it. So we just think Mary's dead, right? So in part three, again, you have Norman dealing with just horrible people. And there's kind of no one looking out for his best interests. And because of his upbringing and the shame that was brought upon him for trying to have any sort of adult relationship with the opposite sex, in comes his mother in his mind and just destroys everything for him. And I don't think the movie is that complex of a psychological drama. It is a very, like I said, a fun kind of, would you call it? I wouldn't call it a slasher. What would you call it?
I mean, it's the closest to a slasher.
I guess that
we get from the site. I don't know. Maybe a like quasi-Yallo movie.
Yallo. Yeah. I wouldn't doubt if Perkins was watching his fair share of Italian GI.
Well, just that red lighting in some of the scenes, I'm like, oh, this reminds me of Argento, man.
Like, I would not doubt if he was watching like opera. You know, what else came out before that Argento did in the 80s? That was pretty good.
I think Phenomena just came out like a few years before.
I wouldn't doubt if he was
the Argento movie with the great Jennifer Connelly, most gorgeous.
Oh, Phenomena! The crazy. Oh, that movie is so crazy.
I love that movie.
That movie is so crazy.
The Bugs. Also, great use of an Iron Maiden soundtrack.
First of all, Italian movie soundtracks, Demons 1 and 2.
Yes, yeah.
Best soundtracks around. Someone says Suspiria, Deep Red. You know, those are some great movies. Look, Argento movie. I'm an Argento fan. I recently read somewhere that the Dracula 3D movie he did that was not very good. He made not very good on purpose.
I have refused to watch it because his latest movie, Black Glasses, I loved that movie. You know, that was like a big return to form. I think it was called Dark Glasses.
Dark Glasses, yeah.
But it's on Shudder now. But mm-hmm. It's not really a Yallo because you know who the killer is. But it's probably his most, I don't want to say left wing, but it has sort of a a pro-social politics to it, because it's really about a blind woman and this little kid who he's from like an Asian background. So there's like there's this idea in it of this little Asian kid and this blind woman having to work together to mm-hmm. survive and not get murdered by this killer, to outwit this killer. And there's like something weirdly pro-social about the movie, and the fact that it came out around the pandemic, and Argento was apparently like terrified when the pandemic broke out. And he made this movie that was very pro-social and sort of about, you know, how we need to rely on each other to get through things. It's actually a weirdly sweet movie for Argento.
I have not watched it. I think that's actually one that's in Italian, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have, because I usually watch stuff at night and I cannot stay awake to read a movie. Like once I'm done with this stuff, it has to be over.
I can feel you on that, but I'd make an exception for that one.
I will have to make a weekend morning exception. I can make the house dark enough to make it creepy. I've never seen Psycho 4. I think I've seen Psycho 4. I don't remember it. You said
Psycho 4. I actually have vivid memories of, and I'm, you know, it's weird. So that movie was directed by Mick Garris, who, Mick Garris is like big in the horror movie community. I've never like had a real like movie of his that I thought was like, oh, I'm blown away by this.
He did May, didn't he?
No, that's Lucky McGee.
But Mick Garris, what did Mick Garris do?
Mick Garris did the Masters of Horror series. He also did that. The Stephen King adaptation Sleepwalkers, I believe, with Brian Krause.
Where the kids screw each other?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
their parents screw the kids, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the cat woman and her cat son.
Yeah.
I mean, oddly enough, that also comes up in Psycho 4 in a weird way, because I don't know what it is with Mick Garris, but, you know, a big part of Psycho 4, the beginning, is... So, I'll give away the plot. The plot is Norman Bates, played again by Anthony Perkins, decides to call into a radio shock jock type show and describe his killings. This movie came out in the 90s. Very apropos, because this is like the rise of Howard Stern and whatnot happening at the time. Late night talk
shows. Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah. And you have Perkins going over his exploits and how he came to be Norman Bates, Psycho. And a lot of the movie is centered around flashbacks of a young Norman Bates. And oddly enough, there's like, they really explore like this incestuous relationship between Norman and his mother, who oddly enough in the movie is played by Olivia Hussey or Hussey.
Okay. From, I remember that. Yeah. I vaguely remember
Black
that,
Christmas. Yeah. And she's probably more known to everyone else for like Romeo and Juliet, 1968. And she's really like the best part of the movie by far, but like it's weird. Like, they really get into like the incestuous nature of the relationship between Norman and his mother, so much so that they're like wrestling on the ground, and then they're wrestling and laughing together. And then Norman's mother goes crazy and is like, "You filthy little thing," you know?
Yes.
Yeah. I felt your boner. Like, so I don't know. Mick Garris explores that territory of both Sleepwalkers and Psycho 4. I don't know what's going on there, but.
So I mean, Mick Garris directed Critters 2.
Yes.
Which
I do like that one a lot, actually.
Is the best of the Critters series. He directed Sleepwalkers. He directed Riding the Bullet. I've never seen that.
Riding the Bullet's a good Stephen King adaptation, actually. But
he directed Nightmare Cinema. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen that one.
And he's acted in a bunch of stuff. Television-wise, I did not realize that Psycho 4 was a made-for-TV movie.
I was going to say it was a made-for-TV movie. And it has the best ending. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, at the end of the movie is the definitive ending to Psycho. I mean, Norman Bates wins at the end. He leaves it all behind and stops being a killer. And, I mean, he burns down the house. You know? I mean, it's a weirdly sweet ending, because you're like, oh, finally Norman is free. You know?
But yeah, you're right. You know, he wrote 4 episodes of Masters of Horror.
Well, he created that show.
He created the show, but he only wrote 4 episodes of it. And I think he's worked on a lot of movies as well, though.
Yes, he has. Yeah.
In some capacity, writing, co-writing. lighting. I think he's one of those guys that has done a lot of stuff in the movie business.
Well, he just loves the genre. Like, he is a horror fanatic. If you've ever met him at cons or anything, like, he does a lot to keep the genre alive, you know, and to, you know, really promote it. But
so, I thought Masters of Horror was a great way to promote the genre. The Masters of Horror, to me, for that moment in time, was like the best horror stuff that was out at the time.
No, Masters of Horror was great. The less said about the sequel series that was on MSNBC, the better. But you remember Fear Itself on NBC? It was Masters of Horror, but they called it Fear Itself, and it was just not.
They edited everything out?
No, it was like a new series, but it was it was supposed to be season 3 of Masters of Horror, but they called it Fear Itself, and it was on MSNBC. It was on NBC. Uh-huh. So they couldn't really do the stuff they did on Showtime.
Oh my God. There's one that was banned from Showtime. Takeshi Miike.
The Takeshi Miike one.
Imprint. Yeah. The
Billy Drago. Imprint. Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus. That's a rough watch. Jesus. That's a rough watch. Beautifully shot. Rough watch.
Right.
We named our band after a Masters of Horror movie. Le Fin Absolute du Monde from Cigarette Burns. The
Cigarette Burns is like one of the best. Carpenter, you know, it's not one of his best movies because it's not a feature length movie, but there's a lot to chew on with that one. I thought Pro Life was a pretty clever sort of inversion.
They of expectations. I felt like getting that group of directors together and giving them. I don't think any of them wrote those scripts, and they were all written by other people, right? They just gave them go shoot this.
Everybody. I don't know what it was. I think they basically said, do whatever you want. And I, you know, I think they may have like given them leeway to like pick a story, or they would pick who would write it. Yeah. I mean, it was known for giving total creative freedom to the filmmakers.
And you can tell.
Yeah.
Argento has a great one in there. Jennifer.
Well, he has two. Peltz and then Jennifer. Oh,
Peltz.
Well.
I forgot he did Peltz as
I
well.
I loved Peltz. I remember Peltz more than Jennifer because that's really? The one where Meatloaf is running around murdering people and wearing their fucking bodies.
I, you know what? I might have been caught up with a succubus too. I might have been in the woods like, dude, why do you keep eating the children? Jennifer, I there were so many good ones on Masters of Horror. I don't know where you can get it. Here in Mexico, it's free on Amazon.
Okay.
I don't know if you have to pay for it anymore, but it's free here. And I've recently went to revisit some of those. There's one, oh God, the guy that did the Phantasm movies. I can't think.
Don Coscarelli, yeah.
The one that he did, which I think is the first one of the series, off of Mountain Road or something.
Incident on and off the Mountain Road.
Ooh. Yeah. That's a great one.
My favorite one of all time, and it's not necessarily the best one, is I think it's called Pick Me Up, where it's Michael Moriarty and another guy. It's dueling serial killers, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's Larry Cohen. And Larry Cohen is an underrated director. You should do a whole episode about Larry Cohen.
Larry Cohen is often slept on. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But that episode, I'm just like, of course Larry Cohen would do a movie about doling serial killers who cross paths and decide my apologies, who cross paths and are like, oh, I'm gonna outkill this serial killer, you know?
Larry Cohen did The Stuff,
right?
He did Q, the Winged Serpent. He did, what else is a Larry Cohen movie people would know?
He wrote Abel Ferrara's incredible underrated 1993 adaptation of The Body Snatchers, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which incidentally starred Meg Tilly.
Meg Tilly was in that?
Yes, Meg Tilly is in that. Yeah. Meg Tilly, Gabriel Anwar, Forrest Whitaker, Arlie Ermey, everyone's in that movie.
I don't remember the reboot of Body Snatchers. I remember.
I have to be honest, I prefer it a little bit to the Sutherland one. Because what it does is it's a reboot that plays on, it takes place in a military encampment, like a military town or what, you know, like a base, a military base. And you can't tell who's infected and who isn't, because, or who is a pod people and who isn't, because, you know, it's like, they don't show emotions. Like, You know, it's like they're trying to, you know, this idea of military people hiding emotions or trying to be like stoically masculine, it sort of uses that to play with this idea of you can't tell who's who, you know.
That actually sounds really interesting. I got to go down. Larry Cohen is also one of those people that's pretty prolific.
I mean, he starts in the movies. He starts in the blaxploitation genre and then moves on to. He did all those movies with Fred Williamson. I think Hell Up in Harlem. And then he did a movie called Bone with Yaphet Kotto, which is a really interesting blaxploitation. But it's a drama. It's like a marital drama. So.
Did he do, people in the chat are saying Maniac Cop. Did Larry Cohen do Maniac Cop?
Larry Cohen wrote Maniac Cop, and it was directed by the great Bill Lustig.
I was going to say, because I didn't remember him directing Maniac Cop.
Cohen's weird because he would direct a lot of stuff, but he also is the writer for a lot of things he didn't direct. You know? His movies are oddly political, too.
We should try to get Larry Cohen, since I'm sure he's not doing anything right now.
He's passed away.
He died?
Yes, I had a chance
to. It was recently.
Yeah, it was like last year.
Oh, okay.
There's a great documentary about him. It's called King Cohen.
Yes.
But I remember when I met him, he was a very like, just like very like Brooklyn, New York type of guy. Like really that, like a personality out of time in a lot of ways. But all his movies are like very political. Like have you ever seen Return to Salem's Lot?
No, because those movies scared me as a kid.
So his sequel to Salem's Lot literally ends with the main vampire getting killed by light shining in through the shed. But the light shines in through like a the symbol of a what do you call it? The hammer and sickle. And the vampires in it are portrayed as like related to the Nazis.
Seriously?
Literally, he did a movie where he basically is like, saying, you know, the commies defeated the Nazis. Like, he's an interesting guy. He would get political stuff in there. Like, even the movie The Stuff that you mentioned. I always tell people it's the only movie I've ever seen where they symbolically blow up a McDonald's. Like, at the end, when they're blowing up all the little yogurt shops, the stuff shops, the one shop they blow up is, like, right next to the McDonald's sign.
Mm-hmm.
The Golden Arches. I'm like, oh.
You know, I mean, The Stuff, there's a few things.
It's a very anti-corporate movie, The Stuff.
Anti-corporate, very anti-consumerism. I'm sure people will call it an anti-capitalist film, kind of. I think it's more anti-corporate because I think the 80s is a time where all the hippies that didn't become, you know, Wall Street bankers or have an office job where they carry a briefcase definitely hated that culture, which was mergers and acquisitions. Due to a lot of deregulation, and that was the original plot of Pretty Woman. Richard Gere's character from the original writer was a mergers and acquisitions guy that had destroyed small towns, and he was supposed to be a horrible man with like no feelings. And I think the original title of that movie is like $3,000. Because that's the guy that wrote it was writing it in donut shops all night in Hollywood, and he would come across sex workers that were from small towns. And the more he talked to them, the more he realized their small town had been kind of destroyed by these mergers and acquisitions where work was moved to places where it was cheaper, usually overseas or down south. And they had lost everything, so they came to California looking for work and ended up getting into sex work. And the more he talked to them, he would find out that they kind of enjoyed these weekends to Vegas with these rich dudes, because that's when they would get, you know, big money, like $3,000. And that's where that comes from.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. The Disney made that movie. Remember that?
Right.
That saved them from financial ruin.
Disney made a lot of weird movies over the years.
I still think Tron is a classic. I mean, now it is, but it was not a hit for them when it came out.
It's very, very true.
We could do a whole other. I don't know if you're a Tron fan. We could do a whole other episode.
I need to revisit the Tron movies.
Just watch the first one.
Right.
I mean, the
sequels don't exist for people like us.
I have young kids. They were young at the time. And we went to San Francisco to go see the sequel to Tron because they didn't understand the first one. They wanted to see the second one. And I fell asleep so quick in that second one. I was like, this is stupid. Jeff Bridges is Jesus. What the hell's going on? So, this movie ain't right.
So since we're talking shop about movies outside of Psycho now, I do have to recommend one movie. If you enjoy Anthony Perkins in Psycho and you also like B-grade trash horror, and I say that with love. Trash to me is great. But there's this movie that came out in 1988. It finally got a Blu-ray a few years ago, but it's called The Destroyer. And for some reason, it wasn't marketed as a horror movie, but it's like a slasher. It's one of the only movies, I think it's the only movie, to star in the lead role Lyle Alzado. I don't know if you remember Lyle Alzado.
Yes, played for the Raiders and the Broncos. Yeah.
Big football player, like, but definitely like roided up. I think he died of like what, brain cancer.
But brain cancer. People,
yeah, a lot of people thought it had to do with steroids.
He said it had to do with steroids.
Yeah.
Yes.
But he stars in it as this guy who gets the electric chair. And then this movie crew decides to make a movie in the prison where he was executed. And it's a trashy women in prison movie directed by a sleazy director, a sleazy filmmaker. And the filmmaker is played by Anthony Perkins.
Really?
And then Lyle Alzado comes back and starts killing everyone, you know, with like chainsaws and all this other crazy stuff.
Destroyer is on my list of movies because as I go down the list of trash cinema on Amazon, so you know how Amazon will recommend more movies for you to see. I'll go down that recommended list. So if you pick one, it's like, oh, maybe what about this? And then I'll go down that list and try to find more. And I'm still a child of the video era where the cover will get me to want to watch a film. And sometimes they don't have the actual cover. That's what sucks about finding stuff, you know, through the streaming era. It's not always the original artwork that was on the cover.
Like sometimes it'll be like a scene still from a movie and it like,
I'm not going to watch. I'm not going to want to watch that. But if you have the original cut, like the cover for the movie, The Exterminator, I'm watching that every time.
Right.
There's a flamethrower and a weird helmet. Every time I'm watching that. All nine of them. Rotor, I'm watching that.
Well, Destroyer has like a great, if you look at the cover, it's just this great cover of like Lyle Alzado with like a machine gun.
Yeah, he's got a machine. Yeah, okay, yeah. I saw that. I was like, yep.
Right. Well, yeah, you get to see Anthony Perkins being a sleazeball in it. You know, like half the movie he's going around like, oh, you need to take off your shirt, show more boobs.
Women in prison movies were very popular in the late 70s throughout the 80s.
And I love the women in prison movies.
And I don't. Are we supposed to say that on air? Are we supposed to make those inside thoughts? I don't know if we're supposed to admit that on air. What do you mean?
I have no shame, dude. I love movies like Reformed Schoolgirls with Wendy O. Williams. With
Wendy O. Williams from 1986?
Yeah.
And she did the soundtrack for it, right?
What's that?
Reformed Schoolgirls.
Yeah. Yes. I love that one. And I love, what was it? Caged Heat with Linda Blair, John Vernon.
Is that the one where Linda Blair goes and holds someone hostage? Or is that Savage Island?
May be Savage Island.
You've seen Savage Island?
Did I have? I have a streaming? I have a subscription to Full Moon Streaming. They have all this stuff. Full Moon.
Full Moon. Puppet Master.
That's how dedicated I am to this.
Besides the Puppet Master movies, some of the other stuff that Charlie Band put out is because Charlie Band didn't do Extro, did he?
No.
Was that New Line?
Extra was like some weird British production.
It was a British production, but I felt like an American company put it out.
I mean, Charlie probably like illegally used one of his VHS labels. I've interviewed his wife before actually on my show.
He's not dead, is he?
No. Charlie's still kicking. I mean, Charlie just released the first feature-length Full Moon movie in years, Subspecies 5.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, But I mean, he's like the little engine that could with his stuff.
All these guys to me are massively fascinating. Charlie Band,
Lloyd Kaufman
over there at Troma. These guys, streaming hasn't stopped them. The morality police from the 80s didn't stop them, because, you know, people have to remember in the 80s, the big studios were looking at these little bitty guys making millions of dollars selling video cassettes to mom and pop stores as a problem to the industry, that they were going to kill the industry. If you remember that, people are like, oh, dude, video cassettes are going to just destroy everything that we love and hold sacred. I do think there's a massive difference between video cassettes and streaming, and I do not believe you can draw a direct parallel there and say, see, it's all the same thing. It's worlds different. The money, first of all, you had to pay to rent a video, first and foremost. Right. You don't got to really pay that much for streaming services. $10 a month is not the same as $3 a video cassette. So there's right there, you have massive differences between the two things. And the amount of money that the Charles Bands and Lloyd Kaufman's and even Roger Corman's were making in the heyday of video was pretty big. Because you figure there was, what, like 50, 60,000 mom and pop stores that needed to carry at least.
No, they made big money, but they often did it by breaking a lot of rules. And
rates be damned.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, I know Charlie, when he did Charlie released I Spit on Your Grave on VHS in I think 81 or 82. Mm-hmm. And I Spit on Your Grave started out in the 70s on the theater circuit as Day of the Woman. He released as I Spit on Your Grave. And interestingly, the cover of that movie, if you look it up, that's Demi Moore. That's her butt in the cover of I Spit on Your Grave, because Demi Moore was dating Charlie Band at the time. So he just he just photographed her for the cover. But he made a deal with the director of that movie to do the VHS release domestically in the US, but he didn't have any rights to do it internationally. But Charlie being Charlie is like, I'm gonna release it internationally, and if he gives me a problem later, I'll pay him back whenever.
So they were just printing money.
He did a lot of illegal stuff. I mean, Charlie's been to jail before, so
they were printing money to the point where they were just like, now we can pay these dudes to make movies. And every so often there were some gems that were made in the 80s.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, because they were able to give these guys that wanted to make these movies, here's $100,000, go make a movie. Here's $200,000, go make a movie. I know you want to. The studio's not going to give you a budget for this. Sleepaway Camp 7.
Go
make a movie. And we get you know, Puppet Master from this, and we get.
Well, what's weird about Puppet Master, right, is like that was in the 90s. I mean, yeah. He was securing. I think the money was secured from Paramount. Because the Puppet Master did so well on VHS, one of the big studios just gave him money for like 4 or 5 years. And he just took it and kept making movies for Blockbuster, you know?
And just printing money. These dudes were just – and the Puppet Master movies are kind of, you know, interesting films, and they're fun, you know.
Charlie is one of the people that made it last until at least like the late 90s, and then, you know. I think it's a different landscape now.
I would love to talk to those guys and see how they still navigate, because they're still making stuff. Lloyd Kaufman is still doing stuff. You know, I don't know. Roger Corman is definitely gone now.
Nope. Corman's still alive, 91.
But he's not doing anything, is he?
No, he's still producing.
What is he saying now? Tits. Ah. Like, what is he saying?
I mean, I have no clue what the hell Corman is doing at 91 producing movies, but I don't even know what it means to produce movies at 91. I'm like, what?
Is he still using footage from like Battle Beyond the Stars?
Oh my God, probably.
If you want to see some good Roger Corman movies, check out Battle Beyond the Stars and Galaxy of Terror.
Galaxy of Terror is amazing.
Check out those two movies. And what else did Corman do?
Slumber Party Massacre, the first feminist slasher.
He did Slumber Party Massacre?
Yeah, he produced it.
He produced that? Wasn't he kind of difficult about the? I know it was a woman director, but didn't he kind of like change a lot on that? Because
I think he's changed a lot of the script and demand it. He's like, you have to show more skin. But I know
because it was supposed to be a comedy.
Yeah, I think the director Rena Mae Brown says she doesn't regret it.
And he made it.
I think the writer regretted it, and it's like that's not the movie I want. I mean, I still think it's fairly pro-feminist as a film, to be honest.
Oh yeah, I mean they cut off his dick at the end, right? The driller killer. Right.
Well, also the guys that are portrayed as ineffectual. It's the women that have to save the guys, you know.
Summer Party Massacre was. I get that confused with Sorority House Massacre.
He also did Sorority House Massacre. All three of them.
Which is the one where the dude, the driller killer, turns into like the Fonz and starts.
The second one, Slumber Party 2.
The Slumber Party or Sorority House 2?
No, it's Slumber Party Massacre 2 with the. It's the Rockabilly one.
The Rockabilly. There's this moment where every killer had to have a witty one liner.
And yeah, everyone was ripping off Freddy.
Freddy changed the game. And everyone wanted to make a killer that was going to be franchisable. And because, again, Jason Voorhees, Freddy Krueger, Leatherface, Chucky were not made to be franchisable.
Right.
That just happened that way. You can't just.
No, there's definitely movies around that time that they were trying to make a new Freddy Krueger.
Oh, like, yes.
Even Wes Craven himself, when he did the movie Shocker with Mitch Pileggi as this serial killer who goes through your TV to kill you.
I wanted to like that so bad.
I enjoy it. I mean, it has like Alice Cooper's
Cooper's in it. You know I wanted to like it? Timothy Leary. Happy birthday today, Dave Mustaine.
Right.
You know, while I'm not a fan of the current right wing Dave Mustaine, I am a big fan of early Megadeth Dave Mustaine, and their cover of No More Mr. Nice Guy was enough for me to go save my lunch money and sneak into the movie theater to watch Shocker. Just sneak in, lie about your age. Yeah, I'm over 17. I'm like 12. 13, 12 years old. And I wasn't shocked. I wasn't impressed. I was very let down.
Ah, well, agree to disagree. I like Shocker. I mean, it's not great shakes, but it's watchable.
And I've watched Wes Craven's made-for-TV stuff. I've seen Deadly Friend 140
times. I like Deadly Friend, but they ruined Deadly Friend because they forced him to tack on. That was supposed to be like a macabre romance movie. You can tell that they tacked on the ending and all the gore scenes later on. It was supposed to be like a Goosebumps type movie.
Yeah, as a Goosebumps type movie.
And then they turned it into a slasher.
It's a great Goosebumps type movie.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Wes Craven's stuff that he did for TV, I thought was okay. It was pretty, if you like made-for-TV movies. I think if you didn't grow up.
Deadly Friend, by the way, was in theaters.
And it shouldn't have got a theatrical release.
Right.
I think it would have held up a lot better in people's imaginations had it not had a theater.
Have you ever seen Summer of Fear, the movie he did with Linda Blair?
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, dude, like I said, they re-released upon his death. They just threw out all this stuff that he had touched when he was doing stuff in between and before Freddy. And they just unloaded it on the DVD market, and I swallowed it all up back then when I had a couple bucks to my name and I could afford to do shit like that. And I watched it all. If Wes Craven's name was attached to it, I was definitely watching it.
Do you like his broadside on Reagan's America, otherwise known as People Under the Stairs?
People Under the Stairs is another underrated classic film that tells a story of, as you put it, Reagan's America so wonderfully, where the bad guys in the movie call each other mommy and daddy.
You can tell they're supposed to be stand-ins for Nancy and Ronald. You
know? And their brother and sister.
Yeah, yeah. and they're portrayed as complete perverts.
Yeah, running around the house with the ball gag and the fucking leather suit. It is. I don't know why more people don't watch that movie. I think for some people, horror movies have to look a certain way. And maybe the movie's just too bright. Maybe the movie's too black. You know, sorry. Sometimes there's movies people don't want to watch. Oh, that's not going to be good. But People Under the Stairs, love that movie. I don't know what happened to that little kid that's in it. He was great as Fool.
Right. Yeah, I love Fool in that
movie. Ving Rhames with hair. A young Ving Rhames with hair is in that movie.
Yeah, Ving Rhames is great in it. That line he has about, what does he say to the kid? He's like, oh, you know, you're 12 years old. Too old for tit, too young for ass. It's the worst age.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, too old for tit. It's too old.
Yeah, you're right. I always mix it up.
Yeah.
He has some quotable lines in that movie.
But that's a fun movie that is just so about what we're seeing in that moment. Landlords. I mean, we're still having people talking about landlords right now. There was a thing. A friend of mine that works in homeless services called me up today and said, did you hear about this party? I was like, I read a headline, but I didn't know how real it was. She goes, oh, it was real. This Landlords Association in Berkeley, California was having a party at a public either restaurant or park to celebrate the end of the eviction moratorium. Think about that for a second. It wasn't like people weren't been getting evicted, right? Like people have still been getting evicted with the moratorium. You had to still prove that, you know, COVID was a reason why you lost your job and couldn't pay rent, which was still kind of hard to prove. But the fact they were having a party, that's like, damn. Just all out in the open. So there was protesters there kind of protesting the get together, and apparently they all got into a big fight. There's a big fight. And I was like, that is disgusting. And if you know, People Under the Stairs is kind of about those people, who they really are, that perversion of power, how it affects the poor. There's so much you can digest. Or dissect, I should say, from People Under the Stairs. Do you like
People Under the Stairs? It's the ultimate anti-landlord movie.
Oh, at the very least, it's the ultimate anti-landlord movie. But yeah. I think Wes Craven, at best, was a liberal. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd say he's a liberal. Like, maybe a slightly left-leaning liberal, but a liberal. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure he would have said he was a Democrat.
Yeah.
There's no hammer and sickle in the deep meanings of, you know, The Hills Have Eyes or Last House on the Left.
I will say this. I do think those directors that came out of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, they were liberals, but like they're more interesting than the ones we got now. I mean, I think, you know, as filmmakers who dabbled in politics, and I do think they did dabble in politics, Carpenter, Craven, Tobe Hooper, I think they all provided more interesting things than a lot of liberals in Hollywood today do.
I think it has to do with their adjacence to the new left of the 60s.
Yeah. Well, they all grew up in like the fervor of the anti-war movement, dealing with Watergate. Yeah.
Also dealing with, you know, kind of dissecting complex texts. There's a lot of, you know, postmodernism that they're reading, I believe. Definitely. They're reading Mao as well as Marx at the time. Right. So, and if they're not deep into it, they're adjacent to it. It's seeping into what they want to talk about. I mean, again, look at Star Wars and George Lucas. That's the most new left, you know, movie of those new left directors that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. And no, definitely.
I don't know what we get with this new crop, because who's close to a movement that was that powerful at that time, especially with one that's taking over, you know, college campuses. We're not talking about like identitarian battles that you see on college campuses now. We're talking about like people really talking about quote unquote liberation struggles and colonies in Africa are now becoming, you know, sovereign nations for the first time because of a lot of these uprisings. So I think they're just next. It's a different time for them to come up in for people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for me, it's like they're surprisingly left wing. Like I said, compared to what we have to, like, for instance, Tobe Hooper, you know, if you watch a movie like Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, like, that's a very funny movie because, I mean, it's an anti-yuppie movie at heart, but it's also sort of a parody of capitalism. I mean, the joke of the movie is that the Chainsaw family, the Sawyers, end up getting rich off their special chili. And like,
secrets in the meat.
Well, the joke is like, the logical conclusion of capitalism is cannibalism. Like, it's a pretty radical, you know, movie for its time to be saying that, essentially.
Well, wasn't the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of a capitalism call out?
I know it was, I think it was just a reflection on the time, Nixon, the anti-war movie. There is an element of critiquing capitalism in it, because the jobs are going away, which is why the family ends up going increasingly crazy.
Yeah, because they all lost their job at the factory. Like, that's kind of a theme.
Yeah.
They even talk about it with these new ones. I haven't really dove into the new ones. I feel like I saw the first two, and that's enough.
Right. I like the first four movies, and I like the new one that Netflix did, but
I haven't seen that one that just came out.
Yeah, Leatherface? I mean, it's not a long movie at all. It's, I mean, without end credits, it's like an hour and 15 minutes.
Talk. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's short.
No, I haven't bothered to check that out because I watched.
I mean, I've become forgiving after having to watch the, I would say, horribly mediocre, and C. Derek Varn would say horribly reactionary, David Gordon Green Halloween trilogy. I've like eased up on newer horror movies. Because I hated the new Halloween movies.
Okay, you're the first person I heard say that, because
it's not. I shouldn't say I hated them, because there's some people that I think are too hard on them. Mm-hmm. But I just felt like Danny McBride cannot write for the life of him. It's literally everything is spelled out. Like, he's literally telling you what to think in the dialogue in that movie. Like, this is what we mean specifically by this. Mm-hmm. And it's, everything is spelled out to the point where I just felt insulted by the newer Halloween movies. And I love the Halloween movies. I will watch any of the Halloween movies, specifically the first six, because I will watch anything with Donald Pleasance. Dr. Loomis is like the Van Helsing character. That
is he
I
in
like
Dr. Reckon. No? Is he the one? Is he
James Bond? He's, yeah, he's Blofeld. Yeah.
Yeah. Halloween 3, kind of my favorite.
I like Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Season of the Witch.
That's an insane movie too, because you watch it now and you're like, wow, the main character in this, played by Tom Atkins, represent Pittsburgh, right? As Dr. Chalice, he is the biggest asshole. Like, he's literally just like, he bangs every woman in the movie and cheats on his wife. He's just like, well, don't mind if I do. I'll have an affair with you and an affair with you. And then he just drinks beer and he gets caught up in like having to expose this killer mask conspiracy. That movie is like deeply anti-Irish, though, for some reason.
So it's deeply anti-Irish. Why is the bad guy doing it? Because he can.
Right.
Yeah, there was no reason behind it, which made it even more kind of like, this movie is dark.
Right.
Everybody go watch Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. I'm so sad that John Carpenter couldn't have got his wish in making the Halloween series of kind of an anthology series. I think that would have been awesome.
No, I definitely, yeah.
I like Tales from the Crypt and Creepshow. I love Creepshow and Tales from the Crypt.
Do you watch the new Creepshow?
I watched a few of the first season and I haven't really caught up with that. I can't really catch up with too much because I read really slow.
Right.
So we have to do so much reading for this show that I can't get into a series. Which is why I've kind of fallen back on my love of a certain kind of film, like a Cannon film or a Malibu Bay film, or like, you know, even some Giallo stuff.
What's a Malibu Bay movie? What do you mean by that?
Ooh, you don't know Andy Sidaris?
Okay, I thought you were talking about Sidaris. That dude was doing the connected, like, that dude was doing the Marvel Cinematic Universe deal. Before that was a thing. You still have characters returning. I love Andy Sidaris. Yeah, and he cast some of my favorite actresses, like Jolie Strang, constantly.
All right, do you know any of these people? Because I would love to talk to one of those actresses.
I actually don't know any of those. I probably have a connection that knows someone, but
because I feel like they're not on, so if they're on social media, they're on as just like their grown, you know, probably grandma self, not, you know,
right.
I had my tits out for an hour and a half in these seven movies.
See, I thought when you said Malibu Bay, I'm like, is he talking about Sidaris? I hadn't heard them before. I always just know them as the Andy Sidaris movies.
They're all the same movie.
Right.
All the same movie. It doesn't matter to me. I just need to see explosions. I need to see ninjas for no reason. I need to see people having intercourse on a beach for no reason. You throw all that in a movie, I'm watching it.
What I love about those Sidaris movies is, like, you can tell he just used that as an excuse to go to places like Hawaii.
They're like all in Hawaii and Vegas.
Yeah, he's just like, I'm going to make this movie in Hawaii. It'll be a vacation. And then some, you know, HBO or Showtime will pick it up and give me tons of money.
Someone says, is it relation to Amy and David? No, spelled differently.
No.
No
relation. I also love that he is most known for creating the honey shot on Monday Night Football.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's the one who pioneered the camera moving towards, like, pictures of the pretty ladies in the audience. That's literally what he's known for outside of those movies.
Because I know he did. They keep saying he made his money in television. He made his money in television.
That's how he made his money. He came up with a honey shot on Monday Night.
I didn't know that. Then him and his wife go into these, making these movies. I just wish I could have been there for him to pitch to his wife, like, the honey, I got an idea. We're going to go to Hawaii. And then.
right. Now you also like the Canon movies, the Golden Globus movies.
I love the Canon. Again, Canon, anything by Bruno Mattei.
I love Bruno Mattei, the Italy's Ed Wood.
I watched Strike Force or Strike Commando again the other night. I had house guests recently, and before they came, I watched Strike Force Commando. Just for that one scene where Red Brown is describing America to this Vietnamese boy who he found in a village. Well, I don't know how this little village boy in the middle of nowhere Vietnam speaks such good English. And Red Brown, who's supposed to be like this massively dope secret agent, doesn't speak any Vietnamese. Why is he still in Vietnam? First of all, it's like 1987. Why is he fighting Russians in Vietnam in 1987? But his description of America, there's a place called Disneyland, and it's got chocolate streets and trees that grow candy.
The great thing about Mattei is this is a dude, like, later in life, he got even more, like, he was known for just stealing wholesale, you know, for other movies. Like, he would literally use the script for, like, Predator and make, like, a RoboCop Predator ripoff with the literal script from Predator. Like, but in his later life, he got so blatant about it. Like, he made a movie in, like, 2003 called The Tomb. And he literally, the exterior shots, he literally steals them, like, from the 1990 The Mummy movie with Brendan Fraser. Like, he literally just inserts shots from The Mummy into it.
Again, these guys, if you guys watch this kind of cinema, they take so many shots from other movies. Just splicing shit. I love it. I love every bit of it. I don't know what they take. I think Strike Force Commando is pretty. They might take some explosions from other movies.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
The kill scenes where the main character, Red Brown, kills entire squadrons of Filipino Vietnamese people with, like, shooting one bullet. Hilarious.
Yeah, my favorite Mattei movie is probably, you ever seen Rats Night of Terror?
I can't watch any movie with rodents. I lived
You're missing
with
rats. Out,
I live with rats.
That's fair.
They make me violently angry, and then I just get ugh.
Have you ever gotten shit for liking the Golan and Globus movies though? Because it's weird. I've met people that are like, "How can you watch those canon movies? They're so reactionary." Like, because they do not take them seriously at all.
Yeah, I'm not watching Delta Force, and then going, you know, maybe the Zionists were right. Like,
I'm not watching 10 to Midnight being like, yeah, Charles Bronson's in the right here.
10 to Midnight. 10 to Midnight. I'm so glad you brought that up. We should have called this episode Jason and JG talk about why they love shitty movies and why you should watch them. I love watching movies, especially if I'm in a relationship with the person I'm in a relationship with, because they're great conversation pieces. 10 to Midnight is Charles Bronson signed on to canon when he was in his 60s.
Right.
And they were like, they loved him in the Westerns and they loved him in the first Death Wish, which I think is 1974.
Yeah.
And they make a sequel to that in 1982. And then they
something
made
like that, yeah.
Then they made four more movies. Mm-hmm. By the last Death Wish, Charles Bronson, who's I believe 70, is jumping out of windows doing barrel rolls in the garbage cans. But all of the Death Wish movies are the same. And then he made a bunch of other movies for canon that are all like Death Wish movies. Kin Jitte, Forbidden Subjects, 10 to Midnight. And there's another one that he made. There's like five more that he made.
Yeah.
They're all on two.
I mean, to be fair, as much as we say like some of these movies are shitty movies, there is often like, I mean, Tarantino has pointed this out with the canon movies. Stuff like 10 to Midnight is actually like extremely stylish for a low budget movie. There are like nuggets of brilliance in these movies.
I mean, it's not going to hold up. Like some of the stuff isn't going to hold up well. Like, right, the killer in 10 to Midnight. This is also around the early times of DNA.
Based on Richard Speck.
Did Richard Speck kill people naked?
No. Well, but like the whole third act with the Chicago.
The nurses in the house. Yeah. Okay. I gotcha.
See, so when I first watched that, the killing naked stuff and just the way they filmed it, like it just outdoors and stuff.
Where dude the camera is running not, over. He's killing people. So the killer in this movie is supposed to be this genius. He's the most awkward person ever. And he does this. He kills people naked because he's not going to leave clothes fibers anywhere, right? That's the whole thing. But he's got a full head of hair, and he's got a hairy nutsack. He's got no body hair except for his dick looks like a Fraggle. If you're familiar with Fraggle Rock, his ball dick hair to butt taint combo is like a Fraggle. So he's probably sprinkling curly cues all over the crime scene, and he covers not his real hair, and he's got long ass hair. But the whole thing is he takes his clothes off. So literally him killing people butt ass naked has to be just a kink. I found that massively hilarious. Right. So he's going around killing people, and Charles Bronson has a cop's intuition that this is the guy that's been killing people willy nilly. And he can't catch him because the guy is just outsmarting him.
Yeah, so he's just like, I'm going to frame him. And then someone finds out and he's like, I don't care. I had to do
it. Yeah, he frames the guy and the guy knows he's been framed because the guy goes, well, of course you framed me because I didn't have clothes on. You said you found blood on my clothes and I killed these people fucking hog out. You know, I was hogged out, brother. And so somebody says, when did Jason see me naked? Like they're scouring the crime scene. I'm like, you guys didn't find any of this dude's nut hairs anywhere? Nowhere? Anyway.
It was the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. It's the 80s. He was probably leaving. JG, this is going to sound gross, and I apologize. Anyone's going to listen and hear this is a true story. 100 to 150 shows a year. And when I say that, I don't mean we played 25 times at home. We played no more than 3 shows at home a year. So I was always somewhere else playing a show for 7 years. Every truck stop, bathroom I used? Dick hair. Every urinal. I don't know if there's a fairy or a Johnny Appleseed character that came in and sprinkled it on everyone. Everyone. Never went to one in all that time that didn't have a little, some seasoning, if you will, over the urinal. And you're going to tell me this guy's going on a killing spree,
right,
and no one's finding anything. But anyway, Charles Bronson frames the guy, and his partner is just too honest and can't lie on the stand. And the guy gets set free. And when the guy gets set free, he goes and tries to kill Charles Bronson's daughter. And then he kills everybody in the house in a real fucked up way. And then at the very end, as he's getting
Bronson is mad as hell.
Right? Yeah, Bronson's chased the guy. The guy just ran after his daughter.
And the killer is like, it doesn't matter. I'll plead insanity and get out anyways. Bronson, no you won't.
No you won't. Bam, and shoots him. There's no, first of all, that guy was running an amazing 4 second 40 with the hog flapping all over Los Angeles.
Right.
There's no way you're running a 4.5 40 like that with hog flap. You're gonna hurt yourself. You're gonna injure yourself. There's no, and he was barefoot. You're gonna barefoot flapping? No way. But again, it's why that movie's so goddamn funny to me. Is because this dude is flapping around Los Angeles butt ass naked. Helicopters are on him and everywhere. And every actor in the scene has a straight face.
Right.
And yeah, the guy's lawyer in an earlier scene says, look, man, we're gonna have you plead insanity and we're gonna get you out of here. He's like, no, I'm not crazy. Like, don't dare call me. He's like, oh, me crazy? I'm not killing these women because I'm fucking crazy. Okay. And then Charles Bronson shoots him. But I think that what that did was that justified what he does with the evidence. And if you think about something like the Night Stalker, an actual case, right, where an actual person was killing people, the only way law enforcement finds out who the hell Richard Ramirez is they had arrested his cousin.
Right.
And he beat up his cousin. This is against the law. They're violating his civil rights. They beat up his cousin. His cousin says, fuck it, his name is Richard Ramirez. Here's where he lives. The rest is history. Do we want to live in a world where law enforcement can beat the shit out of people to get the results? Richard Ramirez really did kill a bunch of people. He admitted to more, and he actually was tied to more killings after he was caught. He's like, oh, remember that old lady in San Francisco? You guys had no idea. And he was like admitted to all the shit he did because he would come up to San Francisco and just wreak havoc. Is that level of policing justified? Now, think about Richard. I can't remember. I want to say Richard Chamberlain as an actor. I can't remember his name, but he was known as the preppy murderer. The same DA and head detective that caught the preppy murderer, the same tactics they used with him, but he was a little older. I think he was like 18, 19 at the time. Were the exact same tactics they use with the Central Park Five. That happens a year later. Does the ends justify the means? All of these movies, this is like the core of my we're living in the Bronson Age thesis. Because of democratically run cities and policies, which we're starting to see get rolled back in the early 80s and late 70s, there's a pushback to the idea that social democracy and programs for the poor are bad. The best way to portray that, is through popular culture. And that's what you see. People on welfare, people aren't working, they're living in government housing, they're pieces of shit. And when we arrest them, because we're also going through a time where we're thinking about things like does it make sense to incarcerate someone for long periods of time? Even Nixon, with his war on drugs, was also wanted to put people in rehab. But the Charles Bronson motto is, these are bad people. Why do we need to put them in rehab? We just need to do away with bad people. Gangs. This was when we get all those school movies where the schools are run amok because you're too nice to these kids. We need to bring corporal punishment back in school. I remember when that was a debate in the 80s. Should we bring corporal punishment back in schools? The Charles Bronson narrative is, sure, I will bend the law, but the law is there to not protect you citizens. The law's only function is to protect the criminal. And that's kind of where we're heading back to now.
Right.
And if you watch these movies, if you watch a movie like 10 to Midnight, and you think about something like The Night Stalker, and you think about something like Central Park 5, you got to ask yourself, does the ends justify the means? Is this the world I want to live in? Because this movie is telling a lot of people, you know, sometimes you got to bend the rules a little bit. And it's only a maverick rule bender. And we all love rule benders, right? It wasn't Steve Jobs a rule bender? Think different. Everybody thinks they're a rule bender. I think different. I do what I want to do. And that's what these guys are doing. Some libertarian.
That's definitely true. I mean, canon is weird because some of their filmmakers, like Joseph Zito, I've often wondered if they were, because Zito did all the, Joseph Zito did a bunch of the like Delta Force, or I think he did Invasion USA. Oh. But he did the Chuck Norris movies. He's also one of the only directors I know that would do an anti-war slasher movie called The Prowler, which literally The Prowler criticizes like a World War II vet. The World War II vet is the villain in it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've often wondered what his politics were, because you watch The Prowler and you're like, maybe he's a little bit liberal. And then you watch something like Invasion USA and you're like, this guy must be a total right-winger. But what I think is fascinating is like that those movies were really made to cynically exploit, you know, Reagan's America. It's like those movies were made, they're like, they knew exactly, mm-hmm. Golden Globus knew exactly what they were doing. They didn't even really care for the films they were making. Like their passion projects were films that you've never heard of. Like in 2002, I think it was Menahem Golan directed an adaptation of Crime and Punishment, which is actually really good. It's with Crispin Glover and John Hurt.
Really?
Like, yeah. It's a very serious, like, drama. Like, when they wanted to do serious stuff, they would do it.
That's true.
Like, you know, ultimately, they were like, how can we make money off all these, like, middle-class Reaganites? You know, it's a very, like, I mean, it's a horribly cynical thing, but in a way, those movies are powerful because they reflect back to you what the culture in the 80s was.
And I think that's what movies do. I don't think a lot of science fiction stuff is super futuristic. I think it talks about a time, and sometimes we just still live in it.
It's like RoboCop, right? Like RoboCop is basically just a giant commentary on Reagan's police state.
Right?
Now it's gotten so bad it doesn't feel like satire anymore, though.
It's neoliberalism in a nutshell.
Yeah.
That was how I did the first movie stream with Ben Burgess. He said, what do you want to watch? I was like, watch RoboCop, because it's the greatest way to explain neoliberalism to anybody. Watch the opening scene. Breaks it all down. And yeah, it also talks about the police state and why it's justified. I went back and watched 1984 some months ago, which is a better movie than I think people want to give it credit to. Because a lot of these movies, too, they're like, oh, when is this movie? 1984 is rather entertaining. But these schools didn't exist. This is all the fantasy of a boomer generation and their fear of the nihilism of Generation X.
Right.
But that fear kind of gets justified with the emergence of cheap cocaine in the inner city, cooked down in its pure rock form into crack. And cut with baking soda. Let's remember that. But that's where that fear gets realized. And all those movies become reality for those people. You know, go back and watch Lean on Me. You smoke crack, don't you? Sing the school song. The Principal with Jim Belushi. Hell, even Wildcats with Goldie Hawn. They're all taking over these, you know, underfunded, shitty urban high schools where these 20-year-olds pretending to be 15-year-olds are just rogue pirates. I'm like, why would they bother going to school at that point?
Right. it's funny because I haven't watched it, but I've been meaning to. You ever seen, it's definitely not in the vein of what you're talking about, because it's much more liberal. But have you ever seen Music of the Heart?
Ooh, that sounds really familiar. Who's in it?
It's Wes Craven directed. I forget who's in it. I think Meryl Streep may be in it. But it's literally, when he did the Scream movies, he said, I'll do the sequels, but give me one drama movie. And he wanted to make this urban uplift movie about, like, I think it was like a white teacher going into the urban schools and like helping uplift the community. I mean, it's kind of dated. It's from 99, but.
This is one of the funniest comments. I don't know if you can see this. Somebody said, one of the guys on the Majority Report explained the difference between crack cocaine and regular cocaine. And all of a sudden the whole staff got COVID. Right. And he says, got COVID in quote.
Jesus.
Sam, don't be mad at me for laughing at that. That's pretty damn funny. Now, I've never seen that. I know he did direct something that wasn't horror. I didn't know that was why he did.
I mean, it's kind of, it's what you're guys, describing, right? With those 80s movies, but yeah. It's like the liberal variant on it.
The liberal variant comes out in the 90s and early 2000s when you have movies like Dangerous Minds, which I just found out. I don't want to say the listener's name. I don't want to out him, but the listener had sent me a link. And he said, check this out, because I think I was talking about something like this. And he goes, this is an interview with the actual woman who Dangerous Minds is based on. And if you watch Dangerous Minds, the woman that it's actually based on says, I hated that film. It was very insulting to me and the students. Excuse me. She goes, I never wore a leather coat. That's just crazy. She goes, I didn't make the kids listen to Bob Dylan. That would have been stupid. She goes, I had the kids listen to 911 is a Joke by Public Enemy because the kids listened to rap music and I wanted them to decipher if this was poetry or not. So I would probably make more sense for me to get something that they were more accustomed to listening to. And she said, I never dressed like them because I wanted them to understand that I was the adult in the room. She said she was never afraid of the kids and they were never really that violent. And I guess there were some things that they also took out of context with relationships she had with kids. I guess one of the writers, and she had to fight to keep this out of the movie, wanted to have an affair with her and one of the students. And I was like, Jesus Christ. These movies, like Freedom Riders with Hilary Swank, 187 with Samuel Jackson, there were similar tales, but they were white savior tales.
And yeah, it's funny because that Music of the Heart movie that Craven did, I think it was another one of those white savior coming to the urban school movies.
What was the show? There was a show. Was it White Shadow? Is that the show where the white guy coaches the basketball team in the 70s?
Oh, I can't remember the name. I don't even remember.
You know, if those movies of the 80s are dark.
Right.
They're very dark. And sometimes they don't have happy. 1984 doesn't have a happy ending. Mm-hmm. 1999 is even more insane. 1999 with Pam Grier and their RoboCop teacher.
So is that Class of 1999?
Class of 1999, yeah.
Yeah.
Class of 1999 is insane.
Have you ever seen the sequel?
Yep.
Class of 1999 2, the substitute with that. You remember? I forget. The main guy in it is Sasha, I think Jenkins or whatever from
the karate guy.
Step by Step. Mm-hmm. The Step by Step kid that played Cody.
Because he's the karate guy that has to karate all the kids into shape.
Right.
It was, again, the solution, which I think why these movies to me open up conversations. The solution in 1984, the teacher just gets pushed too far and ends up killing all these bad kids. And these kids were just so unbelievably bad. There's no school in the history of schools. Because why the fuck would you go to class at that point? You're just going to go do bad shit at home. In class 99, again, why this is funny to me, the school is such a dangerous area that the cops don't come into the school zone. It's like, then why the fuck would anybody go to school?
Right.
So anyway, the solution is to use this pilot program, these military robots, if you will, androids, that are just trained to murder shit. And then they just murder students willy-nilly. They're just murdering the shit out of everybody. And while I don't think we're at a point where we're going to have androids murdering children, because I think children are a great tool for both parties to use to manipulate votes. When we talk about AI and when we talk about privatizing teaching and eliminating teachers' unions, that's where these movies to me become really interesting. Because remember when Donald Trump says, you know, the answer to all these school shootings is teachers with guns. A lot of people are like, that's retarded. Don't do that. Why would? No, that's silly. But one of the things that you hear conservative people talk about all the time is active shooter drills in schools.
Right.
And again, the way we look at justice in this country is through the lens of vengeance. And you need a Charles Bronson type character to, you know, give you your vengeance, give you your justice. So maybe you don't get a school filled with androids with rocket tits like Pam Grier, but you, what if you had a school filled with Green Berets that were armed? Is that going to protect you from school shooters? That's the next. I guarantee there's someone writing that film right now.
Right.
And we're both going to watch it.
That is definitely true.
Someone says teachers with Nick Nolte. Shit, The Substitute with Tom Berenger.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or the crappy sequels with Treat Williams.
Oh, they made like four.
Right.
What gets me is
that, you know, I've read old interviews of Charles Bronson where he's very explicit saying, you know, that what he views what he does as difficult, like portraying yourself in this like rugged manner where you have to have dirt in your face or blood in your face during a scene. But he always like goes back to like, well, I'm playing a fantasy, like none of this is real. And what's interesting to me is we've moved from people like Bronson seeing that as like a fantasy to people like Kevin Sorbo, who were like, no, this is how it should really be. You know, like we should really live in the Death Wish movies.
Yeah.
You know,
it's insane. There's a movie Charles Bronson is in called Ken Jeter, Forbidden Subjects. And I've probably
that's the one where he goes after. I mean, it's really racist in its depiction of Asians, but he's going after like child traffickers.
Child traffickers, and they're all Japanese. This is also when we're afraid of Japan. Like everything you read about China now, replace that with Japan in 1985 through 1990. We were so terrified of Japan, but as being an economic superpower. So Japan is a foreign land where apparently everybody fucks kids, according to this movie. And there's a pimp that instead of getting poor, disadvantaged young women, which is usually how pimps prey on people, this pimp just kidnaps like rich kids. And that's like, that's weird and seems dangerous for a pimp. And Charles Bronson sees him doing his pimp stuff, but instead of arresting him like most cops do when they catch somebody at the time, the crime would have been pimping and pandering. Now we call it sex trafficking, which holds a lot longer time. He busts up the situation with the young lady played by Nicole Eggert and the John. And the John had all these sex toys that he was going to use on Nicole Eggert. And the John tries to fight the cop, which I'm like, and the John looks like a businessman. I'm like, that would never happen in real life. But anyway, I'm going to keep watching this movie because now it's captured my interest because it's ridiculous. And Charles Bronson, after he beats up the John, bends him over and then violates him in the rectum with the sex toy. The next scene, he's at home washing dishes and his wife's like, hey, honey, what's wrong? Work. And she goes, what happened? He goes, I think I might have to look for another job. And she goes, no, you're just being silly. Look, you didn't take any money illegally. You don't sell drugs. I'm sure maybe your temper got the better of you. He's like, oh, honey, you're right. And that never gets talked about again.
Yeah, it's just like, on to the next thing.
This is on to the next scene.
Right.
Nothing happened. I don't even think the man got arrested. He just raped the shit out of that guy. And then went home and was just kind of like, you know. Johnny in accounts receivable is so rude. Like, it's just... Sally in reception keeps eating all the donuts in the staff lunchroom and fucking never saves one for me. Like, that's the way he came home.
Right.
He's not bothered.
It's the absolute ridiculousness of the 80s movies.
You can't do that in a movie today. And in every Bronson movie he did for Canon, he has a scene like that where he's done something incredibly amazing with a stunt or incredibly vile. And the next scene, he's just like, hey, that was yesterday. I'm on to the next, my man.
Right. I mean, that sums up the 80s Bronson movies quite well.
And mind you, in the Death Wish movies, do you remember what his occupation was?
Wasn't he a newspaper guy or something?
No, that's another Bronson movie that is not a Death Wish movie. I know exactly what movie you're talking about. He's an architect.
That's right, yeah.
In the movie where he's a newspaper guy, which I believe is called Messenger of Death.
Right.
Again, a badass newspaper guy, apparently. They conflate Mormons with Mennonites. And it's hilarious.
Right.
Watch that movie, Messenger of Death, with Charles Bronson. It's got one of the best stunt driving scenes on a Colorado two-lane road that you will ever see. It'll keep you on the edge of your seat. So I think. And all this stuff is on Tubi, by the way. I don't know where you're getting yours at, JG.
Dude, I have a massive collection, so.
I'm jealous. When I make it down your way, we have to fucking geek out and watch a bunch of videos.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. What's your favorite Death Wish, by the way?
Death Wish 2 has Larry Fishburne scene where he gets shot in the face and he tries to stop the bullet with a boombox.
With the boombox, yeah.
And he dies like this, like, that's pretty awesome. Death Wish 5 is the one where Charles Bronson, by Death Wish 5, you're like, who is fucking this guy? He has left a trail of destruction with his penis. Families right. have died over
life. Well, by Death Wish 5, you also have like, he'll shoot like a rocket launcher at someone. And you like they very clearly have like an inflatable doll that he's shooting instead of the actor. Like, I mean, they got to a point where they just did not care.
Death Wish 4 is where it ends. He has a regular gun, but it has a grenade launcher on it. And he hits the bad guy with the grenade launcher after the bad guy kills his fiance.
Right.
And then he shoots him. And then the music plays. This like kind of cool 80s jazz plays at right. the end. And he just walks off. That's Death Wish 4, where he took out three criminal organizations. By Death Wish 5, I believe he's taken out seven criminal organizations on his own. This is all after he's gotten his AARP card.
Right.
Death Wish 3, he's using Home Alone type devices.
Yeah, Death Wish 3 is him versus, all I remember is the giggler.
The giggler.
Yeah. See, the great thing about Death Wish 3, I mean, you can say a lot of bad things about the politics of Michael Winner. No one will ever convince me that when he made Death Wish 3, he was most definitely intending that thing to be a parody at that point.
If he wasn't, then he's got problems. The right. Bad guys in Death Wish 3 and the old people, it's like, dude, I've lived in some bad, bad areas. You guys, if you listen to this show, you've heard me say, before I left Oakland, I saw 6 RVs explode. That doesn't count the cars. I didn't hear them. These are the ones I physically saw. And that doesn't count the other ones that I didn't see, where you would just see the carnage the next day. I remember they left about 5 boats in and around our block, and one person left a boat in front of my door. And we had to like go around the building to move the boat. Like, I've been in and lived in bad areas. I've never lived in the Death Wish area. There's people in Afghanistan that are like, dude, I don't need to, it's not as bad as
that. Right, right. I mean, that's, yeah.
It's not as bad over there.
Death Wish 3 is.
When he starts making the Home Alone contraptions,
right,
that's where Death Wish 3 is just like beautiful.
See, for me, it begins and ends with Death Wish 2 in a lot of ways, because that, first off, that is one of the most mean-spirited movies I have ever seen. Oh. And there's something about, I have this visceral reaction where the more mean-spirited the movie is, for some reason I find it kind of funny.
Is it because the black people are like black people? You're like, these black people don't exist in real life.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's part of it. Yeah, yeah. Or just like the level of violence in that movie and like what they do to Bronson's kid. It's just like, Jesus, oh my God.
Christ.
Like, it's so mean-spirited. And then you have that incredible Jimmy Page soundtrack.
Yes. Which they use the exact same one for Death Wish 3.
Right, right. I mean, the soundtrack is like really evocative. I mean, there's good scenes in it too. You know, do you believe in Jesus? He says to one of the hoodlum kids, and he's like, you're about to meet him.
Like, Charles Bront. Dude, we could do a whole nother hour and a half just talking about just the Death Wish movies and not any of the other stuff. Because the other stuff, he actually gets to be a cop in a lot of it.
Right.
And again, he's an architect in Death Wish. In Death Wish 2, his daughter, when he goes to get ice cream and his daughter goes home, and that's when everything goes to shit. He like walks by some thugs, and then they decide to go, they steal his wallet, and they decide to go in his house. And then I'm not going to get into it because it's kind of disgusting. But
have you seen, so Michael Winner, who did the first 3 Death Wish movies, in the 90s, he did a movie called Dirty Weekend. Have you heard of Dirty Weekend?
No.
It's Death Wish, but with a woman. And it's an anti-rape movie where Michael Winner is basically saying, I hope these women go around shooting rapists.
I don't really believe any of these movies are anti-rape movies.
Right.
Like, Last House on the Left, Mother's Day.
Right.
I Spit on Your Grave. Rape as a plot device in horror movies for a woman to get her comeuppance. I think there's a pro wrestler that has a line about that in one of the Searching for Darkness. What's the one that's a big horror guy that has a band?
Jericho.
Chris Jericho has a great line where he goes, when you watch what these women have to go through, regardless of what they do to get their comeuppance, is it really worth it?
Right.
And when I saw they remade I Spit on Your Grave, why did you feel that this was a movie you should remake, right? If you've seen, it's a really hard, if you have a soul, it's a hard watch.
Right.
And they made like four of these remakes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the director Miris Archie from the original just made a sequel to the 1978 movie.
Why?
Right.
It's like they're really.
No, they're tough to watch. I mean, I've been known to defend I Spit on Your Grave, but they are tough watches.
Look, I've seen it several times. I'm gonna sit here and act like I haven't seen it before. Definitely when I was a very, very young person, you know, watching it way too much. But
right.
I mean,
well, the thing is, I mean, even I'll admit, even if someone like Miris Archie had an anti-rape feminist intent, I mean, it's a commercial movie.
Yeah.
Making money off, you know, the salacious content. So, I mean, it is problematic, is what I'm saying.
I mean, I'm not saying there's not horrible men out there.
Right.
But much like the Death Wish urban landscapes.
Right.
The I Spit on Your Grave landscapes are equally as like, bird?
Right, right.
these people are pretty fucking, these are monsters. Again, there's people making a lot more money than you and I, JG, talking about real instances of stuff like that in the true crime world.
No, yeah, totally.
But, I mean, I don't know what I'm supposed to take away from that, from those movies. Like, just don't mess with them? Or, like, what am I supposed to take away? Like, I had no intention of doing anything like that with anyone.
Right.
There's nothing that happened in this movie that would have crossed my mind as a thing to do upon meeting a stranger. You know, some Deliverance shit.
Right. I finally watched Deliverance recently, and that, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right? Squeal like a pig.
Right, right.
Like, what?
It's weird because it's such a small part of the movie, actually, but it's what everyone remembers, you know, so much so that, I mean, it's really more of like a survival film, but people almost remember it as a horror movie just because of that one scene.
Well, because everyone has to watch it happen. Remember, his friends have to, like, watch it happen. It's not like right. It happens in the dark and he came back, you know, blood leaking out of there. No one knew why. Like, it's like, oh. Like, that's part of the power. Like, I'm going to make all your homies watch me do right. this to you. Nothing you can do about it. That's, like, wolf. I've been to the Ozarks and I've been to the Appalachian Mountains. Never did anyone, you know, threaten to tie me up and give me the 1-2 skidoo, make me squeal like a pig. Again, it's one of those like it's almost like Rob Zombie. It's like Rob Zombie really hates poor people. I believe that in my soul.
You think he hates poor people, Rob Zombie?
Yes. I think he hates poor white people. From the South. He's an East Coaster through and through.
That is not my interpretation of it. We'll have to talk
really?
About
that. Really? Oof.
Yeah, I'm a big defender of Rob Zombie, much to the chagrin of everyone I know.
Are you going to pull off your face and your Sherry Moon?
Right. Have you seen 31?
Which one is 31?
31 was the one with the poor Southern sort of carny folk ending up in like a rich person's like death game. He did it a few years ago, but I thought it was fairly like, I mean, it's fairly sympathetic to the poor, that movie. I mean, for what it is, but.
Someone said he convinced him to get dreads. Well, we're going to have to get Rob Zombie on our Jason and JG B movie review, talk about movie show, and have him defend his East Coast, Midwestern Southern hate, because I think it's just typical. You people in the East Coast just have a thing against the South. The Civil War is really real for y'all.
I could see that with some of his earlier films. I'll give you that. But
he tried to redeem himself.
I think 31 does a lot of interesting things with like how it portrays poor Southerners. So But I do like House of a Thousand Corpses is just total Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Fair that
yes, yes. More
Southern people, you know. I also I've always defended him because I like what he did with the two Halloween movies where he had the girls in those movies. I mean, I don't like the remake that he did. I like the second one. But I like that he had Danielle Harris and Scout Taylor Compton talk the way they did in those movies. Where they talk like 16-year-old girls that are obsessed with sex and they're crude and rude. Because to be honest, I knew girls like that growing up, you know? I mean, I think he's interesting with his portrayals of women in some of his movies because, you know, I haven't seen many horror movies where the teenage girls are, they're not acting like pristine little virgins. You know? In the Halloween movies, they're just like totally open about, they're like, I want to fuck this dude. I want to do this with him, you know? And I admire that he like doesn't portray girls as like those like types of teenagers as like just cardboard, you know, one dimensional sort of. They'll never talk about that. They're too pristine or whatever. But
you have to be your box, right? Either you're going to be the slut, or you're going to be the kind of airhead, or you're going to be the virtuous.
Right. Hero. Right. Yeah. Yeah. He sort of breaks that up a little bit, I think, at times. Also, he's the only director I know that will cast like women over 40, over 50 in roles that are considered like sexy.
I will say I share that with him where he'll go back and cast people that he liked when he was a young person. Like he had Terry from Three's Company. In one of the Devil's Rejects. And I think she actually, if she doesn't get topless, she at least gets in her underwear or whatever. And E.G. Daly plays kind of a sexy role, and she was probably like 50 when she did
it. Yeah, E.G. Daly was in that movie 31 I mentioned, and she plays a killer clown named Sexhead. She's playing this sort of like overtly sexual role at like over 50 years old, and I respect that he's willing to do that because, you know, not many filmmakers do.
Again, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that these are like women that he.
What's that?
I think there's a woman that he had a thing for when he was younger.
That's probably also
E.G. Daly from, you know, Valley Girl. Like I said, Terry from Three's Company. The woman from the Police Academy movies that would always go, and you get a set of brass balls this big. And she had like the big boobs and the sunglasses. Remember her? She's the mom that's arrested in the Devil's Rejects movies. If you remember that, she was talking about how she would seduce the cop's dad. Remember that?
No.
Devil's Rejects. Go back and watch Devil's Rejects. She's the in the early scene. She's the mom they lock up.
Okay.
The mom and the family. So he definitely. Oh, the
Leslie Easterbrook character.
Uh huh.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. I know. Now I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like he goes and does that thing.
Oh, where... also, how can you not? I mean, in a weird way, The Devil's Rejects is like this anti-cop movie because you end up realizing that like the sheriff is more screwed up than the family.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's things I like about his movies. I do take your point about the depiction of poor Southerners, but
I think he has a thing against them, man. It's just a thing. I don't know what it is. Again, maybe we have to meet him. I think you like Rob Zombie because you like Thunder Kiss 65.
Hell yeah.
that's why you like Rob Zombie. That that's all he needed for you was that riff. Great song. Hey, we've been talking for 2.5 hours. It flew by. Thank you so much for hanging out with me, JG. I really appreciate this.
So before we go, what's the next movie?
You're over here asking serious questions. If you want to be serious, I think we should do a whole Death Wish rundown.
I'm down with that. At some point, you should come on my show. I need to find someone to talk about my favorite John McNaughton movie other than Henry, which is Wild Things.
Oh, okay.
Wild Things is an interesting movie. It has sort of the poor trash girl ends up triumphing over everyone in the end.
Dude, so. I watched Wild Things as a young person because it came out in 99.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not joking. I unironically like that movie.
That was I loved that movie.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it. Like, I've seen
there's
it
years. Nothing redeemable about it. I like it though. Yeah.
A lot of people are pretentious and suck. So.
Right.
I don't believe in guilty pleasures. Like what you like. Don't let someone make you feel bad for liking what you like.
I hope that comes through, by the way, because like I do, I mean, I talk about a lot of these movies and call them trash and whatnot, which a lot of them are, but I unironically do like sort of B movie and Z movie type stuff. I think they have a lot of interesting, you can find a lot of interesting hidden gems.
Sometimes there's editing moves that you see like, oh, that was an interesting cut. You know, I was watching someone talk about Miami Connection, and they brought up a point that, you know, these guys were doing the slow-mo action jump in the air to kind of quick stuff way before you saw John Woo do it. This is like maybe 20 years before you would see it in an Asian action film. And they're doing an insane movie about a mediocre band that's stopping drug dealing ninjas. Like there's stuff in a lot of these movies that make it like I can watch American Ninja unironically and enjoy it because I was 7 or 8 when my stepmom took me to the movie to see it. Any movie with, because she was a martial artist, so any movie with martial arts in it, she would take me to see until she had my siblings. But
were you a fan growing up? I promise I'll stop asking questions, but were you a fan of the Shokasugi ninja movies?
Yes!
Enter the Ninja. The first one I saw was Ninja 3, The Domination.
We've watched it on movie night.
Oh my God.
We watched Ninja 3, The Domination on movie night because I told people it was like, it's The Exorcist, Poltergeist, Flashdance, and a ninja movie. Thank you, listen to Dickie. Oh, dude, Pray for Death, Shokasugi. His kids are... JG, I'm 46. If it's got a ninja in it, I'm watching that film. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Amen to that. I mean, my favorite... No, I get it, dude.
If someone is getting killed with a ninja star, that should be more of an, hey, that hurt. But actually, like, takes out a gunman. I'm watching that movie. I thought that ninjas were the cool. I still think ninjas are the coolest thing in the world.
That shows you're showing your 80s child there.
Oh, dude. Anything that transforms blows me away.
Right.
If you showed me a flip phone right now, I'd probably lose my shit. Look, you pick the film. If you want to watch Wild Things, you want me to come on your show and we talk about Wild Things, brother, you say the date. If it works out, I'm on. This is for me, this is fun. I hope you guys had a lot of fun going down memory lane.
We went way beyond Psycho 2.
We went way beyond Psycho 2 and 3. And again, I want to end by saying this. I think Psycho 2 is one of those sequels that should be up there. And I'm not saying this as a joke. I'm not saying this ironically. It's up there with Godfather 2, with Empire Strikes Back. I think it's that good. JG may not agree with me.
I totally agree with it. I mean, you'd be surprised the people that hold it in high regard. I think I know Bret Easton Ellis is a big fan of it, the guy that wrote American Psycho. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure Tarantino is. James Wan, who did the Saw and Insidious movies, is a big fan of it. I mean, I know people in Hollywood that hold it in very high regard. And I do think it may be the best horror sequel, you know, or one of the best.
I was telling Ben the other day, I was like, Ben, I just watched Psycho 2 for the first time in probably like 20 some years, maybe 30 years. And it's amazing. And he goes, really? I was like, that's what I'm saying. You just see that.
Because people say like, oh no, Psycho 1960, that's all that exists. They never even see the second one and how different it is.
The 80s for a lot of people is camp personified. And what you like about it is the idea of the camp and maybe going back down memory lane. And you forget that there is some really good shit that comes out of this time period. Well-acted movies, some beautifully shot movies, some amazing stunt work, blow-your-mind practical effects. Think about the 2000s in horror. What a dark time in the genre that was, as people are trying to figure out CGI. Because again, we're trying to eliminate these practical effects guys that are making way too much money. And the CGI in something like the Thing remake or reboot or prequel, whatever the fuck you want to call it, is really horrible. And it doesn't hold up to the practical effects, the skillful editing, the skillful cinematography work of the first Thing in 82.
Yeah.
I like these movies because I find them entertaining. Yeah, there's a little memory lane stuff for me. But like the Andy Sidaris stuff, he found a formula, it worked, and it is an entertaining movie. So go back and watch Psycho 2. It is not campy at all. It is a very great slow burn mystery. Doesn't matter that we told you about the movie. You can go back and watch it. Like, that was pretty good. Anthony Perkins and Meg Tilly are wonderful on set and on the screen. And I can't believe they didn't get along. I read that similar thing that you read, that they didn't get along on set because she said something like, who the fuck is this guy?
Right.
And yeah. Blew my mind. Psycho 3 is also a fun kind of campy romp. Watch them. JG says don't watch 4.
I mean, I would watch 4, but it's just not my favorite of them. You know, it's, yeah.
Tahir says it's not all John Hughes, Robert Zemeckis, and Canon films. Well, John Hughes can eat so many dicks.
I was going to say also, for anyone that watches Psycho 2, watch out for the Hitchcock cameo.
I just read about it. I didn't see it. I gotta watch it a third time.
20 minutes in. It's not actually Hitchcock, but
yeah, it's a silhouette. It's
the infamous silhouette.
Tahir says, shout out to the Toxic Crusader, though. Yes.
Yeah, shout out to Troma in general. Have you had Lloyd on the show yet?
No, I reached out to their people on their website and no one got back to me. So if you have an in to Lloyd, since you're on the East Coast.
Okay, I'll try. Yeah.
I would appreciate that because I would have fun with Lloyd. If you want to come on and do an interview with me, you're more than welcome.
Awesome.
So thank you, JG. Thank you, everybody, for watching. We will be back tomorrow and we'll be talking with Paul Prescott, who said to me before I even pitched the show, he said, Jason, read this piece. I believe it's the best thing I've ever written. Paul, as you know, is my friend in real life. I read it. I think if you liked our show yesterday, which a lot of people did, a lot of people definitely, or some people disagreed with what we had to say, you will really disagree with a lot of things in the show then tomorrow. And you can hate watch it. Hate watch it and share it with your hateful friends. Make sure you share the hate. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the unfulfilled potential of the March on Washington with Paul Prescott. We'll be back to our regularly scheduled programming. Until then, we are out.
So glad that you're in America. I said, well, I know a lot of Russian filmmakers. They have a lot more freedom than I have. All they have to do is be careful about criticizing the government.